We will call the meeting to order. This is the State Government Finance Committee meeting for Wednesday, March 23rd, 2011. Members, could we come to order, please? Let's see, I think we're still a couple short of what we need for a quorum, so we'll just start receiving testimony. First up is Margaret Kelly from MMB.
We come from farthest away.
Yeah, and we're here first.
Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Margaret Kelly. I'm Assistant Commissioner and State Budget Director at MMB. And Commissioner Showalter sends his regrets that he could not be here himself for this conversation, but he's happy to meet with any of you at any time. I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify this morning in front of your committee. I appreciate all the hard work that goes into putting together a budget bill, and especially when revenues aren't sufficient to fund all your competing resources and priorities. As a department, we're still reviewing the language of the bill to fully understand all the provisions, but there are a few provisions in the bill that we would like to comment on today. First, I wanted to say that we're opposed to the unallocated appropriation reductions in the bill. While we recognize that recent budget bills in the past have contained small reduction amounts that MMB was directed to allocate across state agencies, and we recognize that your bill contains provisions that hopefully will generate savings, the size and the scope of the unallocated reductions in this bill is unprecedented, and it will be difficult, if not impossible, for MMB to manage. Specifically, in Article 1, Section 37, there's a $95 million unallocated reduction. The draft bill also includes estimated revenues from tax analytics software and a federal offset program that are not substantiated yet by fiscal notes and would require additional unallocated reductions of up to $170 million if revenues were not realized. Although the provisions in this bill aim to achieve budget targets by giving MMB the ability to reduce agency budgets, the bill does not give us the authority to eliminate the work currently done by departments. The tools at MMB's discretion to make reductions across state agencies are administrative in nature only. We cannot change services required by law, and reducing the workload of state agencies requires the legislature to make policy decisions about what should no longer be accomplished by state government and to translate those decisions into state law. The unallocated reductions in this bill would be in addition to specific proposals to reduce agency operating budgets by anywhere from 10 to 64% included in this state government bill and other bills in other committees. Reductions of this magnitude cannot be absorbed by agencies without help from the legislature to determine what agencies will no longer do. Second, we're opposed to the unallocated reduction in the state workforce. This bill targets a 15% reduction in the size of the state's workforce, with 12% occurring in the next biennium. This translates into an elimination of 1 in 6 positions and is set without consideration of the work directed to agencies by the legislature and expectations for performance. Again, the decisions on what work the state should or should not do rest with the legislature, and once those decisions are made, the executive branch and its management role can bring the proper assets to bear to implement those decisions. The size of the state workforce is a result of decisions by the legislature that certain functions should be performed. Changing the size and composition of the workforce should be linked to the reprioritization of the work to be performed. Transparency in government, and specifically in budgeting, requires that we clearly show which services state government will deliver and how budget decisions will impact those services. These two provisions, unallocated reductions to appropriations and to the state's workforce, separately and more importantly when combined, result in significant service impacts that will not be identified or understood until well after the legislature adjourns. Third, we're deeply concerned by the 13% operating reduction to our agency. To manage a reduction of this magnitude, we would need to eliminate at least 30 positions in our department. You may recall from testimony we provided a couple of weeks ago that our overall general fund budget has been reduced by 25% in recent years, with some divisions in the department experiencing a 50% or more cut during that period of time. This has translated into a 34% reduction in our staffing, or 127 employees. Work has been redesigned, delegated, and discontinued to accommodate these reductions. Squeezing further efficiencies is unlikely and impossible with the level of reductions in this bill. We will simply need to begin doing less with less. We can't tell you today exactly which services would be discontinued. We'll need to choose between core services and functions. To help illustrate the magnitude of this reduction, this is equivalent to eliminating the entire budget services division, all of the forecasting staff, and the majority of the internal control and accountability unit. No one in this room wants to hear about government fraud committed by state employees or by program recipients. We have worked in partnership with the legislature to establish our internal control and accountability unit in response to valid criticism from the legislative auditor that we were not adequately ensuring proper controls over financial processes and systems across state government. We could undo the good work that we have spent the last 2 years trying to achieve. We would be challenged to protect and maintain our core business systems, hiring and paying employees, keeping accurate financial records, knowing how much of the budget is spent and yet available. We would be challenged to meet the state and federal requirements related to banking, accounting, payroll, insurance, procurement, and information access. Our inability to meet these requirements will risk our AAA bond rating that we have worked hard to achieve and to maintain. Our agency is incredibly stretched for resources right now with the implementation of an enterprise resource planning software package, while we're also redesigning our budget development systems, our IT systems. We will be challenged to both complete these projects with this level of reduction and further challenged to support these systems once they are operating. A further concern regarding the MMB operating reduction is the expectation for new activity by MMB, zero-based budgeting, increased use of performance measures, and an agency sunset commission, to name a few. These are activities that require staff resources beyond what we have today, and not only are the costs not accounted for in the bill, but with significant operating budget reduction, it would limit our ability to pursue proposed changes at the same time we would be reducing our capacity to support existing core services. Finally, we ask that as you finalize your bill in the next few days, that you be cognizant of the interactions that these provisions have with other budget bills and with amendments you may consider to this bill. We're concerned that the overall impact of interactions that may have on the fiscal accuracy of your bill and on the competitiveness of the state as an employer. Regarding fiscal accuracy, given the lack of transparency and the unallocated reductions to budgets and staffing statewide, we cannot determine whether this bill accurately reflects the fiscal impact associated with all of the provisions, or if some of the savings are double counted and therefore represent much deeper cuts than initially thought. For example, do the FTE reductions that will occur as a result of the MMB operating budget reduction account towards the 15% statewide workforce reduction target? And if so, are they in addition to this target, the savings? And do the estimated savings from the salary freeze adjust for the savings associated with the 15% reduction in employees statewide? Our staff are ready, willing, and able to help you work with your staff to determine the fiscal impacts across provisions in the bill. Last, I'd like to speak to the competitiveness of the state as an employer. One of MMB's core functions is to ensure that we recruit and retain the best talent for the priority work of the state. In considering this bill alongside other amendments and omnibus bills, it will be important to ask, when the session is all settled, what kind of state government will remain. Will Minnesotans who are entering the workforce consider public sector employment and see state government as a viable employer? Will the workforce that remains be up to the tasks of running the state's work with fewer resources, or will the cumulative impact of the various provisions that may be put into this bill impact our ability to recruit and retain the best talent for the challenging work employees do every day? Again, thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today about our concerns, and as we continue to review the bill, we'll communicate what suggestions we do have. Don't hesitate to contact myself or Jim Showalter, Commissioner, if you have any further questions.
Ms. Kelly, I hope you can understand and appreciate the fact that some of these fiscal notes have been very slow in coming, and we have some serious questions about some of the, what these notes have shown. You mentioned the offset in particular. Frankly, that appears to be way under what the potential is there. You indicated that you don't like this provision, that if it doesn't meet the revenue expectations, that you don't like having MMB put in the position of having to figure out how to deal with that. I can understand and appreciate that, but is there any way to avoid that? I mean, we're talking about doing some things here that the state of Minnesota hasn't done before, and therefore we haven't had experience as a state in doing some of these things. And should we just avoid doing any of these things that might save? Or do we have to all understand that there are going to be some uncertainties here as we implement these things that are projected to save money?
Mr. Chair, those are both very good questions regarding the timeliness of fiscal notes. I think that staff in state agencies and in MMB have been working diligently on getting the governor's supplemental budget before all of you, and that may have put added strain at the same time that you are putting together your bills. We kind of have a perfect storm this year in that your timeline and the timeline of a new governor's budget delivery have kind of collided, and I fully expect that fiscal notes should be completed relatively quickly going forward. In terms of what you could or should assume regarding some of these new ideas that you have, clearly we need to consider every option before us. I think the challenge is when things are so new that it's difficult to assume savings, we need to work very closely with you in booking what we think are accurate savings that can be achieved in a reasonable time frame. I think we have seen issues in the past where we have worked with the legislature to book what we consider a reasonable savings. Some provisions where we have done kind of a backstop, where we've said if you don't achieve this level of savings, then make an unallocated reduction, have been very limited in dollar amount, in the $2 to $5 million range. What concerns us with this bill is just the magnitude of kind of the backstopping that we're doing, that it could be between your bill and other bills in other committees closer to $500 million, which becomes nearly impossible for MMB to allocate across departments.
Well, I hope you would understand and appreciate that if those who do the fiscal notes are telling us that the revenues aren't there, that's probably going to result in a whole lot more ideas coming forward that are going to further complicate this. And the more changes we put on the table, the more complicated it becomes. We certainly understand and recognize that this is a complicated process because each one of these initiatives may impact another one in terms of what you can get. And I would hope that we would have some tolerance for each other about we're trying to work through and find ways in which we can solve this problem, and we're going to have to make some changes in the way we do business. You know, the other thing you talked about was the unallocated workforce reduction. Now, the governor has also proposed a workforce reduction across the board as well. Doesn't the same concern apply there?
Mr. Chair, first, to respond to your earlier comment, we're happy to work. I fully recognize this is going to be a complicated and difficult budget to put together, and we'll work with you in whatever way we can to get to an end. In regards to workforce reductions, the governor's budget does have reductions in agency administrative budgets that will translate into workforce reductions in the, I believe it's the 3% to 5% range, 5% range. And I think what concerns us is going up to a 15% allocated reduction, a 15% reduction, a target, setting a target what we'd like to achieve with not identifying what work we want to see reduced or eliminated is a challenging proposition, not knowing the impact of those reductions statewide.
Well, I understand that, and it isn't 15% in the next biennium, it's 12 is what's in our bill.
Correct.
And I hope you're not asking us as a legislature to specify all of the particular reductions we ought to make. Certainly some agencies are able to make more with less difficulty than others, and I sure hope you're not asking us to specify what positions you want us to say we want eliminated. You're not asking for that, are you?
Mr. Chair, I don't think I'm asking that you specify positions. I think I'm asking that you take a look at the work that state government does and determine what level of service you're willing to accept or you want us to achieve, and we can tell you if that will get to the 12% reduction that you're looking for in the next biennium. For example, do you want our park systems fully staffed or partially staffed? Do we want I think those are the sorts of questions that we're looking for. Are we, if you're hoping to achieve this through attrition alone, that agencies can, as we look in the past 10 years, MMB has seen a reduction in a significant number of employees, and we've managed slowly over time. But when you're trying to achieve it in the short term, it's going to be require more strategic decisions about service levels. And we're looking to the legislature, I think, for direction in that service level changes.
Well, Ms. Kelly, we fully understand and appreciate the concerns that you're raising, and I hope you would reciprocate in understanding our concern here. And the more the fiscal notes tell us that the revenue isn't going to be there, the more it's going to cause us to generate more ideas that will further complicate this whole situation. So thank you very much for being here today.
You're welcome, and thank you.
Representative Stensrud had a question for Ms. Kelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Kelly, maybe just a follow-up. I don't need an answer right now, but maybe I know on the fiscal note for the federal offset program, it looked under the assumptions that in the collections, there's supposedly a fee generated by your department, and I guess I don't see where there's an actual number in terms of any money being added. You book all of the costs associated with the collections, but you don't actually book like any sort of a fee for doing those collections. And you know, we don't assume that you would bear the burden of all those costs. We would assume that there'd be a corresponding fee associated with that. So maybe a clarification in how that cost structure would be. I'm certainly not an expert in the federal offset program, but it seemed to me I didn't understand why that fee looks to be not accounted for in this fiscal note.
Ms. Kelly?
Mr. Chair and Representative, I haven't looked at the fiscal note. We can certainly do that and get back to you and see if our assumptions matched yours.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next is Mr. Spartz. Mr. Representative Lilly.
Mr. Chair, to the chair's questions, I guess I grew up in small business, and I work for a big business. But I'm shocked that you, Mr. Chair, would say to them that we're going to cut 12%, and that you don't want to be involved in that decision. You can't just say you're going to cut 12%, and they're going to like make that up. I mean, you got to pick. I mean, do you just drive in this morning? I drove in. You know, are you going to pick snowplow drivers? Are you going to pick, who are they going to, that's not probably germane exactly, but my point is you got to pick who you're going to cut. I mean, you just can't throw out 12% and just say, absorb this over and over. I mean, this budget is, it's just unbelievable. I don't know. I'm just thinking about it, and you just say, cut 12%. I just can't believe that you're not going to do the work and step up and do that. I mean, you seem like a honorable person. You know, I don't know. I just can't believe it.
Well, Representative Lilly, for 201 legislators to micromanage where we're going to find reductions, I think, is an impossible sort of task. And that's what we hire well-paid managers, administrators to be able to do. And if you look more closely at Representative Downey's bill, he's proposing that these reductions would be made through attrition, through early retirements, through a combination of factors. And it's not going to happen all at once. It's going to happen over the next 2 years. And so, anyway, Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Kelly. Ms. Kelly, would you provide us with a copy of your remarks, please?
Mr. Chair.
Ms. Kelly.
I'd be happy to.
And Ms. Kelly, I don't know if you can speak to it now, but if I could have a... I didn't know about this, what went on in this committee before this year, but I do know that budget and management is a new name. Is it a new department also?
Ms. Kelly?
It was a combination of several, wasn't it?
Mr. Chair, Representative, it is a combination of the former Department of Finance and the former Department of Employee Relations, and there was someone else, the Management Analysis Division of Admin.
And, Mr. Chair, Ms. Kelly, if you could provide me with, and perhaps others want it too, at the time that there was this combination, was there budget savings then, and or was it just streamlining of delivery services?
Ms. Kelly?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I believe at the time that Finance, Stewart, and MAD were merged, there was a target reduction of $500,000 assigned to the new department to achieve through efficiencies and overlap reductions.
And, Mr. Chair, in number of employees also, or not?
Ms.
That's a number I'd like to know.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I don't believe there was a target for employee reductions. There was just a target for dollar savings to be achieved.
And that was $500,000?
Yes.
Okay. And
Representative Murphy?
Ms. Kelly, just one last question. Was there anything in the bill that you or your department said, yes, this is reform? About is there any article or any section that you said, yes, this is reform?
Ms. Kelly?
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's a great question, and I think there are provisions of the bill that we have looked at in the past and thought about and considered, but have not taken action on regarding budgeting and performance budgeting. I don't know the extent to which we would assign budgetary savings to those. But be happy to look.
Members, our next testifier has a tight schedule here. Thank you, Ms. Kelly. And representative from the Association of Counties, Mr. Spartz, welcome.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. My testimony this morning arises out of a bill introduced by Representative Murray, House File 163, that was earlier heard, and it involves giving county boards the option to select a private auditor rather than have the state auditor do their financial books. We have had this policy on our books for some time in our platform. It has become more general in that we now include it under a section that refers to supporting the idea of public-private partnerships where they provide opportunities for counties. I would like to make a very few comments here. First of all, we recognize the right of the auditor, state auditor, regardless of whether or not there is a private audit firm involved in doing a county's audit, to set the framework and the standards for that audit so that proper public disclosure is done at the end of the day. Secondly, we recognize the right of the auditor to assure at the end of the audit that those framework standards have been met and that the audit has been appropriately conducted. There's been concern raised about whether or not working papers would be private or public. Often, private audit firms' working papers are held privately. If the legislature desires, I believe a one-line amendment would say that at the end of the process, when the audit is accepted, any working papers involved pass over into the public domain. That should satisfy that concern. Representative Kahn then raised an issue about how does the legislature properly budget if it's unknown at the time how many counties are going to use private auditors, how many are going to use the state auditor. I think you could appropriately create a opt-in, opt-out cycle that would give the auditor and the legislature proper notice of how many counties during a biennium would be under the supervision of the auditor and how many would be outside of that. In terms of counties that are interested in getting permission to do private audits, Stearns County has had several exchanges with the state auditor about this, and that's one of the things driving our support of this proposal. That's my testimony, Mr. Chairman. Any questions? I'd be happy to try to answer.
Mr. Spartz, would you have some language that you're suggesting here for amendment?
We can provide some if it's desired.
We'd appreciate seeing that in writing, what you're proposing to change or modify here.
Very well. We will do that, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your being here. Next, we're going to go to Commissioner Kronk. Welcome, Commissioner. Please identify yourself for the record.
My name is Spencer Kronk. I'm the Commissioner for the Department of Administration. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members, for allowing me this opportunity to testify before the committee. I've been Commissioner now for 1 month, and in that time I've learned that all the ways that admin achieves our mission of helping our customers succeed, nearly everything funded by general fund dollars, either as important statutory functions or goes towards government efficiency and reform, which we have been doing for years. The impact of passing House File 577 would have severe consequences in our ability to perform high-quality expert services to other state agencies. Besides the direct layoffs that would occur, I would like to highlight a few programs that would be severely affected. Our Small Agency Resource Team, or SMART programs, provides human resource and financial reporting expertise to small boards and agencies. This bill would reduce the number of small agencies, boards, and councils served. These entities do not have the resources to complete work. We would be unable to assist agencies when they experience a crisis, and no doubt that audit findings would increase. Our Information Policy and Analysis Division, or IPAD, provides training and technical assistance to citizens and government on data practices and open meeting law issues, and helps to ensure that government understands their obligations under the law and that citizens can enforce their rights. The goal of these laws is to promote transparency in government. With the passage of this bill, IPAD would discontinue responding to questions or providing free training on data practices and open meeting law from citizen, media, and government customers. IPAD would also reduce the number of advisory opinions accepted based on staff availability. It is of note that these advisory opinions provide a safe harbor from civil and criminal penalties for government and can ensure attorney fees for citizens who later sue for enforcement of their rights. Admin also oversees the state's procurement of real estate services, and some of the impact on these services would include our capacity to manage 1,500 commodity and service contracts on behalf of the state. That would be cut significantly. It would severely limit our ability to ensure inclusion of minority, women, veterans, and other protected groups in state purchasing and contracting. It would eliminate resources to help state agencies reduce space and related costs. It would eliminate resources to implement best value construction procurement practices. It would eliminate resources to implement energy efficiency improvements in state buildings and reductions in energy consumption costs. That concludes my testimony, and I'm happy to take any questions.
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Kroc, thanks for coming. What you've just commented on, as I understand it, is just and only what would happen under the recommendation here of an overall cut of $4.6 million for the biennium. What I want to ask you is what could come to you over and above that, and that is the 12% cut over the next biennium in your personnel. So if in addition to what you just testified, if you took a pro rata share, if all the agencies, and I know the bill doesn't specify this, but if, for example, the Dayton administration determined that it would handle a 12% mandate by saying that every agency would take a pro rata share, a 12% cut, if above and in addition to what you just testified, you also had to shed 12% of your employees over the next 2 years, could you talk a little bit about those impacts?
Mm-hmm.
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative Simon, certainly we'd have to look into the impact specifically on those cuts, but in general, the rates that other agencies would be using for specifically our leasing services would go up significantly. As an enterprise-wide service that we provide, it is clear that it would be impacted by other state agencies who would have to increase their would have to pay more to admin for the services that they receive. But beyond that, I'm happy to look into it more to see the severity of those cuts.
Well, thank you very much, Commissioner. Appreciate you being here today.
I'm not so sure.
Commissioner Parnell? Welcome, Commissioner.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members. I too appreciate the opportunity to speak to you about the concerns that OET has related to the proposed cuts to our budget. The cut to the Office of Enterprise Technology is 15% out of our general fund, which will affect our planning and management and our IT security program. We are also concerned about the general fund reductions MMB must make to all executive branch agencies, as that would only increase these consequences. The Office of the CIO is statutorily obligated to ensure the delivery of efficient and effective technology that protects state investment and enables reform. We do this through the setting and propagation of standards and best practices, as well as oversight of state IT investments and projects. These cuts will increase statewide risks, result in higher costs and lost opportunities for savings, and erode enterprise planning and investment management, for example, the development of standards that reduce redundancy. These cuts reduce our ability to lead enterprise IT process improvements and efficiencies, and our ability to provide oversight of state investments. The cuts will most severely affect our security program, and I have our Chief Security Information Officer here to testify to the effect of those cuts. Chris Boozy.
Welcome. Please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Christopher Boozy. I'm the Chief Information Security Officer for the state of Minnesota. First off, thank you for giving me a few moments this morning to testify. As we've testified before this committee in the past, the information security program exists today to help protect the state of Minnesota against some sophisticated security threats that exist today and impact all government agencies. Since the inception of the enterprise security program about 4 years ago, one of the goals of our effort has been to really transform the way information security has been done in government, moving us from a completely decentralized model where every agency performs these services on their own to a centralized model where we can leverage our economy of scale, and where ultimately we think we can provide security services not only better but more cost effectively by sharing resources. We set policies and standards and baselines for the government. We do operational services such as helping ferret out vulnerabilities in systems and forensic investigations. We're helping develop the skills and tools to monitor government systems. And obviously, as I mentioned before, all of this is done in an environment where we share security tools and staff with all the agencies. At a 15% cut level, we analyzed our budget and our numbers, and one of the things that we really had to do is we had to make some painstakingly difficult choices. When we created the program, we couldn't address all of the security problems that existed in government today. We were starting at a pretty low baseline level. But we did select certain services that we thought we were going to focus on that had the highest payback to all government agencies. With the 15% cut, one of the choices that we're going to have to make today is to look at those services and figure out which ones we're going to do and which ones we're not going to do. And that is really my role as the executive that leads this program, to figure out of the 85% that would be remaining, what's the most beneficial to the government. At the 15% level, we believe that we'll have to eliminate about 23% of the staff that's funded through the general fund appropriation. Some of the direct service impacts that we can expect to see is we've been working very hard to provide enterprise leadership and disaster recovery and business continuity planning, and that is one of the functions that we're simply going to have to wait to a later point in time in order to provide that kind of assistance to agencies. We simply won't be able to afford to have the planners that help agencies provide those services and the tools that we have today for agencies to help document their plans and practice and test their activities. We simply won't have the resources to fund that from a centralized level. We'll have to really revert back to the model where every agency is really on their own in this area. We also will have to eliminate other areas as well. One that I think will be particularly painful to the agencies is that we've established a training fund to help improve the overall competency of security professionals in state government, and we certainly won't have resources to provide training services to agencies anymore as well. But we do understand the fiscal situation that the state is in today, and we're going to do our part to make the best strategic decisions that we can with the money that we have available at our disposal.
Thank you, Mr. Busey. Representative Kahn.
Mr. Chairman and Commissioner Parnell, when I first started working in this issue, there was a line in the budget, it was actually 16, that listed all of the information technology expenditures for each agency. Can we ask you to pull that line out of the budget for us, or can we pull it? Can our fiscal people pull it out? Is there one line in the budget that will list all of the information technology, or is it more complicated now?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kahn, I think that if expenditures are specifically coded to IT, we can pull that out. There may be other costs that won't be evident, as I understand it, in those expenditures. But I can certainly pursue that and come back to you with that information.
Yeah. Okay. I would like that information of the IT expenditures in each. And what kind of costs would escape that?
Commissioner?
I think that those kinds of expenses that are in our view may be more related to applications than they would be to actual IT infrastructure or security costs.
Well, Mr. Chairman, what's an example of the difference between those two things?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kahn, there are rent expenses, facilities, et cetera.
I'm sorry, in which category would that fall? That would fall the ones that you couldn't attribute to technology?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kahn, I would rather not commit to an answer here and go and get the right information for you.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, I would like that information, not just for the agencies in this budget, but for all of them across the state, and I would like it, if it's, I guess if there's an agency that's paying rent, I don't know that I want to take out the part that's occupied by personal computers or things like that. But if there is a computer system that's specifically in a facility that's being rented for that, I would like that number, too.
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, thanks for your testimony. I'm going to ask you what I asked Commissioner Kronk, and that what I think I'll be asking almost every testifier is, could you talk about the impact to your agency of an additional 12% loss of people? If your pro rata share of the 12% statewide workforce cut were that 12%, let's just say, could be higher, could be lower, I understand, but let's just say it was 12% across the board for every agency, what, if any, function would have to go? Or what function would be diminished if you had to get rid of 12% of your people by the summer of 2013?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative Simon, I have not actually undertaken that kind of analysis myself. I have been on the lookout for areas where I think we might be overstaffed or areas that we might obsolete systems or services, but I do not have specific information on that. I am pretty convinced at this point that we run fairly lean, that we do have the right resources in the right places, but I do not have a ready answer for you.
Representative Birdall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner. If 15% is too great a reduction, have you given thought to what percentage you could absorb as a department and continue to provide the services at a comparative level to what you're doing now?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative, no, but I can certainly take another look at how we categorized what those cuts would be and prioritize them and get back to you.
Representative Downey.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Maybe just a response to Representative Kahn's question. I believe the Excipio group that did the consulting study, I think they told me it was like a 3,000-page set of binders that created an inventory of every IT asset in the state. I know it was not disclosed to the public because there's certain information in there that I think might somebody could possibly use to identify, you know, vulnerabilities and things. So they wanted to keep the security components of that private. But I do believe we as legislators can have access to that. And I don't know, maybe it's a question for the CIO or Mr. Boosie. Does that contain the facilities information as well, or is it just the kind of tangible assets?
Mr. Boosie?
Mr. Chair, committee members, I don't have a precise answer to all of the information in your question, and we can certainly get back to you on that. The report itself does contain a lot of the detailed technical information that would allow people to identify specific systems with specific operating systems in specific locations that would make them more prone to attack, and that's really the reason why, you know, the real gory details have not been made available. But the kind of information that you're looking for about facilities, I believe that information could be compiled for policymakers if necessary.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Banyan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I believe, because we talked about this last month, that this committee sent you a letter asking for information and asking you to contemplate 15% and 20% cuts. Some of what we got here is we shouldn't act like this is something that just happened last week. This is something we've been talking about for a good bit of time. And as you looked at that, you know, there's sort of looking at more fundamental changes that you need to make in your organization. And this is a question I believe I could have asked of any department. Maybe I should. You know, tell me about the guiding principles within that. Okay, as you thought about building that your organization, your office up from zero, what are the organizing principles that bring you to make the decisions you're making now? And in particular, I want to ask, how is it that training falls in the 15%, training your users falls in the 15% that you don't do? Because to me, that would seem to be a priority of what an Office of Enterprise Technology would do, is to engage fully the people you have working with you and using the technology to find further efficiencies in government.
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bannion, Mr. Boozy may have further comments, but I would state that these cuts affect our general account funding. And that was a conscious decision of the legislature to centrally fund security. So the training that's being referred to is training around security. And I think the reason, and it was a good one, for centrally funding the security program was that it was an effort that had to be built from the ground up and had to be propagated around to all the agencies in the state over the last 5 years. I think they have done an excellent job of that. Mr. Boozy is recognized in the country for the work that he's done in this state. So the training is specific to security and getting the agencies on board with the security requirements that we have established in our security program.
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you,
Mr. Chairman. Ms. Parnell, Commissioner Parnell. I go back to the idea that if you can have good security software, but if people don't know how to use it, not sure we've made the best investment on our dollar there. Again, I'm trying to figure out what that guide is, and I guess maybe I put it to you this way: if you thought about it from where you started to now, and you thought you're going to have 85% of the money rather than all the money, would you have made the investments you've made?
Commissioner?
She wasn't there.
Mr. Boozy?
Mr. Chair, committee members, the answer to your question about, you know, what's the theory behind the decisions that we made, mm-hmm. I think the first thing to start off with is we are trying to build those leadership services to provide services more effectively across the entire government. And when we started the program off, we tried to focus on those activities that we thought would give the highest payback to the state. When we're cutting resources out of the pool, we're making difficult choices, and there are really no good choices. So the criteria that I really used when I was deciding, you know, if we absolutely have to, what are the things that we're going to jettison? We glop the services really into three buckets. Those type of leadership services that'll protect the state and prevent bad things from happening. Those things that we'll need to detect bad events from happening and help, like forensics, to help agencies get on their back on their feet to minimize damages. Then there's that final bucket that we call corrective controls, where the continuity of operations and those kind of things fall into. That what do we do if everything falls apart and we have to somehow have a way to get the state back up and running in time of crisis? And when you have to make tough choices, the real criteria that I used was I really tried to start by cutting out the corrective controls, because there's not actual fires burning, right? It's kind of like not buying insurance in a way. But even making those cuts, the numbers still didn't work out. I had to cut more. And that's where we went into the preventive controls, and that's where the staff training came into play. And we needed to cut more to get to the 15% target. So that was the logic that went behind it.
Representative Bannion, I'll end after this, because this is more a comment. By the way, it's not you in particular. I have this concern. Again, I could do this with any commissioner that's come up here. I just happened to get the question formed properly in my head when you were in the chairs. So please don't take this as personal. I think my comment is, in a world where we know, particularly now, right now, we've got revenue streams that are quite volatile. I think one thing that agencies and departments need to think about is the fact is the idea that you're going to have occasions where this type of scale back is going to happen. And what you've just described for me, Mr. Boozy, is a problem of indivisibility and the inability to do some scaling of the type of work you're doing. And that may just be the nature of that technology. And I need to respect you as an expert in that field. I don't necessarily understand it. But I think we need to think about the fact that you live in a world where from time to time you will see decreases in revenue from economic change. And the fact that we haven't, as a legislature, gone back and looked at the volatility in our revenue stream and thought about maybe we need to do something about that, take some of that cyclicality out of it. And as long as we're in that world, we probably need to think about the fact that we need programs and even security that has some scalability to it. And so that may be more of a suggestion than a question, but if you have a comment, please.
Would you wish to comment, Mr. Boozy?
Mr. Chair, committee members, I definitely understand the issue, and I can say wholeheartedly that we are trying to build systems that are scalable, and we certainly need to figure out ways to reduce the operation as revenue streams fall as well. And when you're looking at cutting 15% of the dollars out of the operation, the brutal reality that we all face, both as agency leaders and as policymakers, is that there's really painful choices that need to happen.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know that Ms. Parnell has not been in her position very long, but she has been a part of the system. Mr. Boozy, how long have you been at the Office of Technology?
Mr. Boozy?
Mr. Chair, committee members, I was appointed the state's Chief Information Security Officer a little over 4 years ago. Until I was appointed, there was not a security leader in our state. The operations were handled agency by agency.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Anderson.
And this could go to any of the testifiers coming up here before, but I just wonder what your office has or what you've done in the past 4 years in your position or others in their positions for reform ideas as to how you run and how you better run your agency, not only necessarily Office of Technology, but Department of Administration, Department of Revenue, whoever, and just your thoughts of what you've got maybe on the plate now or have had and you've refined that for reform ideas for your office and others?
Mr. Boozy?
Mr. Chair, committee members, that can be a very long answer, so I'll try to keep it brief.
Yeah, please don't make a long answer.
Since the inception of the Enterprise Security Program, we've been working to provide more robust centralized security services that have a real impact on agencies. We've testified before this committee multiple times about the work that we've done, for example, in centralized vulnerability and threat management across government, putting in people, processes, and tools where we ferret out critical security vulnerabilities out of government systems before they can be exploited by hackers. Today, we assess all government systems at least weekly and help agencies find and fix problems before they're exploited. We've done work in monitoring, similar work, security monitoring, try to improve our situational awareness. We've done work in computer forensics. We're helping set consistent baseline security standards for all the government. We've been helping with continuity of operations planning, just to name a few of the types of areas that we put our resources to since we were created about 4 years ago.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you. And Mr. Boozy, what are some of your reform ideas going forward, other than what you've just outlined?
Mr. Chair, committee members, one of the things that I'm proud of with our program is that we have both a strategic security plan for our state as a whole and a tactical security plan. And if you go on OET's website and you look at those documents, you can see the vision and the direction that was created by not only myself, but through a governance process that includes all agencies. And there's a series of initiatives that fall into the general buckets: proactive risk management, robust crisis and incident response, and the types of activities that we can do for preventive security controls. So the big activities that we're working on is really trying to look at those things that we can do once across all agencies to try to do them centrally, make it consistently available to all government agencies, not just those that have the dollars in their pockets, and provide a consistent baseline security level for everybody in the government.
Mr. Chair.
Representative.
One last time. So, Mr. Boozy, you've anticipated this type of a crisis that we're in right now as far as economics go.
Mr. Boozy.
Mr. Chair, committee members, any government leader that that has been watching the news over the last 2.5 years absolutely knew that this is the kind of issues that we'd be facing down the road. There's a tremendous shortfall between what we have and the current proposed expenditures, so I think everybody understands the gravity of the situation.
Thank you. Representative Kahn.
Well, the first comment is to point out that Mr. Busey was just outrageously stolen from the legislative auditor's office, where he had done super work, so he has much more than 4 years of experience. And then the next thing is the number that I'm interested in is not really the value of facilities and that kind of thing, but I'm interested in the ongoing costs to be running them is the number that I'm interested in.
Right, I understand.
Okay, thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, I would just like to comment on a couple of the questions related to the security program and just point out and remind people that getting this security program up and running and refined is and has been done in the face of increasing security concerns and threats that come from everywhere every time you turn around. So it's like a rising tide, and I think that's where the concern about cuts comes to security, to balance that rising tide with ongoing security needs and requirements is of great concern.
Representative Gauthier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner and Mr. Busey, first of all, thank you for coming, and I know that you've been busy getting the governor's budget prepared and whatnot, so I'm not going to chastise you for not responding until today, which I think is the appropriate time to do so. My concern is when we talk about rising threats and whatnot and 15% reductions, and I don't know if this is for you, Commissioner, or Mr. Busey, but what I really heard was this reduction is really adding to the threat of security violations. Is that an accurate analysis of what you're saying?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I don't know that it's adding to the threat, but I think that the concern is we have to always be ready to respond to that increasing threat, and if our ability to respond is reduced, that's where the concern comes into play.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Gauthier.
So just for clarification, it's response that's being endangered right now by these reductions.
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, committee members, the threats are there. They're part of the environment. How well we're prepared to address the threats are what we're doing with the Enterprise Security Program.
Mr. Chair.
Commissioner, or I should say Representative Gauthier.
I wish I was a commissioner. They pay better. I guess my alarm is, you know, I don't understand how we can make more reforms with more cuts. And so could you speak to that in relation to security in particular? I mean, how do you do that when we keep hacking away 22% staff reductions, 15% in your budget? I mean, how does that facilitate reform? It's beyond me.
Commissioner, or Mr. Busey?
Mr. Chair, committee members, it's a good question, but really when you look at what we're doing with the Enterprise Security Program, it's all about government reform. It's about trying to put in place centralized tools and process that can be used by everybody. So the whole program is reform. As we cut the program, it reduces the amount of reform we can do. But as I mentioned, my job is to say whatever hand of cards that I get when this is all said and done is to take those resources and try and provide it to make as effective of security decisions as I can, and that's what we'll do.
Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Busey, and members, we need
this
to,
is my last
we need to
statement.
Move on. Thank you.
I really want to thank you for that response, because I think we expect state employees to respond accordingly, and that you all do the best you can do. And that's why we value you so highly. But I think there comes a point when the legislature needs to get into reality and quit making unreasonable expectations of our fine workforce.
We have two more members on the list, but then we need to move on. We've got a whole long list of people that wish to be heard yet today, so Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have the copy of the letter, the response to this committee regarding the 15 and 20. I do notice that even with the governor's cut of 5.6%, that your answer was that insecurity management reduction result in the loss of a security consulting position and a couple of more lines. So, you know, we're aware of, in fact, that your answer said that you would see a loss commensurate with even the governor's. My question is, the security threats are, they're not unique to the state of Minnesota. The Defense Department has reports, the federal government has reports, every state. What are you doing to leverage the information and knowledge that's gathered by so many agencies doing exactly the same thing and turning that into a response that we can use without nearly as much potential resource allocated to, you know, kind of reinventing the wheel? Is that any part of coming up with how you might react to a 15% cut?
Commissioner, Mr. Boozy?
Mr. Chair, committee members, it doesn't necessarily address the funding shortfall. There's not magical funding out there that we can tap into that will help insulate us from a lot of the cuts that we have today. But with the Enterprise Security Program, we're well connected with the federal government, the Department of Homeland Security, and through a group that's called the Multi-State Information Sharing and Analysis Center. So we do leverage our federal partners to a great extent, and the federal government helps provide state-level government threat advisories. We analyze that. We help our agency partners. We also help counties and local governments understand the risks as well. So though those partnerships don't necessarily help us with the resource problem, those partnerships do provide us with incredible information that helps us do our job better and pass that information on to the people in the trenches who really need it.
Representative Downey.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Boy, I just think we need a little context here. The Office of Enterprise Technology's entire budget is $211 million. And the general fund component of that is $10 million, so a 15% cut of $10 million, a $1.5 million cut isn't even a 1% cut out of the entire Office of Enterprise Technology function. So we just need to be careful. I know Mr. Boosie's area is probably funded through the general fund appropriation, so they're dialing in on that. But we heard a really comprehensive report analyzing technology functions across the state, 1,800 people, according to the consultant study, a ready-made opportunity for, I think it was 226 people that could be, reduced through a consolidation effort over time. I don't think we're gutting this function, and to imply that a 15% cut out of our $10 million general fund appropriation somehow decimates what we're doing, I think is a really gross overstatement. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chairman.
You were next, Representative Kahn.
Well, I just have to, I think that shows a gross misunderstanding of how this agency is funded. And one of the issues is that they're mainly funded on paybacks from the other agencies, and they're not allowed to charge, you know, what any grant you would usually do, any grant from the federal government, is an overhead component, is that there are things that probably should be paid back from the agency, which they have to totally pick up from their general fund appropriation. So I think it's really, you know, there are things that could be done to mitigate that general fund cut, but you really have to change what the charges to agencies can be used for. And so, you know, I really think it's Representative Downey, you know much better than to what you've just said to underestimate the effect of that general funding cut. So you've just been caught up in this rhetoric of how we have to cut and cuts don't matter without going into the in-depth knowledge which I know you possess.
Representative Downey.
Very briefly, Mr. Chair. The broader point is that we're somehow the discussion is that we're somehow gutting this function. I mean, in the Technology Revolving Fund, we've got, what, a $17 million retained earnings balance. The federal government is thinking about coming after that because technically we shouldn't retain earnings from federal expenditures. So, again, just to look at a $211 million budget and recognizing that, yeah, there need to be some policy changes to affect some of the chargebacks and things, fair enough. But, boy, to sit here and think that we're gutting our technology function with a less than 1% overall cut through this general fund appropriation, I think, is extreme.
Well, Commissioner and Mr. Boozy, thank you for being with us today, and appreciate your attendance. Before we turn to the next members, I've just been informed that we have two birthdays in the audience here today. One of them is the distinguished Representative Phyllis Kahn.
They get a little...
Yeah. And the other is our distinguished page, Travis Wasluck. Hey. Now, I'm not going to embarrass either one of them by asking their age.
But Travis,
I think you came along after Phyllis joined the legislature. Well, happy birthday to both of you. And if I had known this in advance, we would have had a cake here in the middle of this. But we'll have to give a rain check on that. So thank you. Next, we'll call forward the Revenue Department. Welcome.
Mr. Chair and members,
please identify yourself for the
good morning.
Record.
I am Matt Mossman, Assistant Commissioner for Tax Policy with the Department of Revenue. And with me this morning, excuse me, are Terry Steenblock, our Assistant Commissioner for Individual Taxes, and Greg Cheetah from our Office of CIO. Thank you, Chair Lanning, for taking the time, first of all, to sit down and meet with the department last week and discuss some of the various tax compliance initiatives that the committee's been considering. We really appreciate your thoughtfulness and the time that you're taking to craft a response to what is obviously a significant budget deficit. And we hope to continue partnering with you and the committee and talking with you and the committee in the remainder of the session to craft a budget. Let me start, first of all, by just stating that the department is open to new and innovative ways to administer Minnesota's tax laws and to reduce our tax gap. Minnesota Department of Revenue was a leader among states in implementing e-filing efficiencies that resulted in the Department of Revenue vacating an entire floor in the Stassen building by 2004. That was the department-initiated effort. The department has been seen as a national leader in tax compliance. Since 2002, at the direction of the legislature and with ideas initially developed in the agency, we have increased tax compliance efforts through a series of initiatives, collecting $4.1 billion in tax compliance efforts since 2002 and about $625 million generated per year from tax compliance efforts. In 2008, the department began implementing our new GenTech system, which replaces legacy systems with a common platform so that the department and taxpayers can both experience enhanced and more efficient tax compliance efforts and tax administration. And in December 2012, we roll out phase four of our GenTech system. And during this, I would add that during the process of implementing GenTax, the department has reviewed each of its tax administration processes that go into the system so that we didn't build in old and inefficient processes that we used. I highlight a few of the past successes only to underscore that we are open and looking for constant improvement. And I think that's what we've been hearing a lot from the committee this year and this session, and looking for opportunities to do things differently. But we also have meaningful experience and awareness of how alternative tax compliance strategies will work here in Minnesota. As Ms. Steenblatt can discuss in more detail, Minnesota Department of Revenue already has a federal tax offset arrangement with the IRS. And as Mr. Cheeto will be able to discuss, when Gentex is fully phased in, our system will position us to do better target tax compliance efforts through the use of data analysis. While we are continuing to review the overall budget proposal, we do have three general observations that we would like to make about the budget proposal. First of all, we believe the budget proposal and spreadsheet should reflect a $111 million general fund revenue loss due to the 15% operating reduction proposed in the state agency budget. We believe that there would be an additional loss as a result of the budget reductions that would impact the Department of Revenue as a result of the Minnesota management and budget managed cuts to state agencies. And we're continuing, Mr. Chair, to review that number, and we would expect some revenue loss there, and we will clean up that number and provide the committee with some information later today. Why is that? DOR collects taxes. We do that through a myriad of ways that foster and support voluntary compliance, and we also do that through compliance efforts and those for those who do not comply voluntarily to the tax code. If there is a substantial loss of our resources that we use to do compliance and to support tax compliance efforts, there's just simply going to be less tax revenue collected. The methodology that we've used to make these estimates is the same methodology that we've been using to discuss these same and tax compliance proposals over the last several years. We also estimate that the federal offset proposal will generate about $4.3 million over the next biennium rather than the $36.6 million reflected in the spreadsheets before the committee, and we're able to talk about why that is in more detail later, but essentially it is largely to do with the fact that we already have a federal tax offset program in place and have been collecting revenues under that proposal. DOR welcomes tax analytics, and as I indicated, we have planned for it as part of GenTax, but we are not comfortable with the current revenue estimates or bill language as proposed. In the end of the day, tax analytics tools better target tax compliance efforts, but audits still need to be conducted, assessments need to be made, and collections need to be processed. Minnesota has been engaged in tax compliance for many years, and we are skeptical about the proposed order of magnitude on top of the existing tax compliance efforts that's assumed in the initiative. With that, Mr. Chair and members, I'm going to turn it over to Ms. Steenblatt, and there's been some questions earlier during the MMB testimony as well with the tax offset fiscal note, and just to talk a little bit about that proposal and those numbers in particular.
Ms. Steenblatt, you may proceed. Please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, members, for the record, my name is Terry Steenblatt, and I am the Assistant Commissioner of Individual Taxes. As Mr. Mossman mentioned, there have been some questions on the fiscal note, and I'm going to walk through how we came about the estimate that we've provided to you. As we've already noted, the Department of Revenue currently has offset agreements in place with the federal government, which has already resulted in a significant amount of money, and I'll talk a little bit about that in a bit here. But we currently offset our individual income tax debts. If people have tax debts, we can send those to the federal government now and notify them, and then before they issue refunds, they submit what money is owed to the state back to the state of Minnesota. In addition to that, we also partner and we reciprocate that back to the federal government. So they send us a notification if somebody owes. So they send us a notification if somebody owes a federal debt, and we offset that refund and provide it to the feds before we send the remainder or any refund back to our taxpayer. So when we looked at the fiscal note and we were working on making the revenue estimate there, you will notice that we did project for the FY12-13 biennium a projection of $4.3 million. FY12, you will notice, is lower than FY13 in future years. And the reason why that is because we would not be able to start the implementation for this particular program until two different things occur, one of them being the implementation of SWIFT. Because with the reciprocal agreement, the component that we don't have and we need to implement There is a relationship that occurs with the vendor offset, and that would be integrated within the SWIFT program. The other component of that is, as Mr. Mossman mentioned, we have rollout 4 of GenTax. That will be the implementation of non-tax debts into the system. So we need to get those into the system before we can start this process there as well. So with that being said, we estimated that we would not be able to start this program until approximately April 1st of 2012, which would be significantly into the FY12 biennium. Once we have the system or the process in place within the system, we are required by law to send notifications to the debtors. And the federal government requires this in order to participate within the program. The requirement for that requires that the notification be sent 60 days and that the taxpayer be provided with 60 days before we can submit any requests to the federal government. So we have that factor coming into play here as well. So really what we're looking at, that estimate of $500,000 may be somewhat difficult to collect, but we're optimistic that, you know, within that 1 to 2 month time frame during the fiscal year 12, we may be able to generate that. Some of the other things that we took into consideration as we looked at future years, because we already have some of these components in place and we're picking up the vendor offset component, that applies to businesses. And so one of the things we needed to do when we established that fiscal note was look at current debts that we have and how what percentage of those are businesses for both the tax side and the non-tax side. And so when we made our projection based on what we have today, we currently have 50,000 business debts. Now, one taxpayer can have more than one debt. That was the current population on the tax side that we have. And something that's important to note there is that many of these debts would most likely not have federal contracts available because they're local businesses, they're small businesses, or they're businesses that typically do not have federal contracts, for example, bars and restaurants, things like that. So as we look at that 50,000, what we would have to do is really narrow that down to those that would qualify for the vendor offset program. In addition to that, we looked at our current population of non-tax debts. As you may know, the Department of Revenue collects all state agency debts. And in reviewing that, there are currently 3,000 non-tax debts that would potentially qualify for the vendor offset program. And those include things like deed debts, UI debts, or pollution control debts. So that was another factor we looked at, is the number of debts we have and whether or not they would qualify. We did take into consideration the results with the federal offset program that we currently do with the feds. And this is when they send us refunds for individual tax debts. And our annual averages change slightly from year to year, and they change because there may be stimulus refunds or people may have less refunds. There's a variety of factors as to why that may change. But we did look at our results for federal offsets, and in FY09 we had $6.6 million, and in FY10 we had $8 million. So that was another factor that we did take into consideration. We looked at our own historical results with our own vendor offset program with state debts. We currently do have the ability to offset our own state debts with vendors. So if a vendor is doing work for Minnesota, before they would get paid, MMB looks to see if they have a debt, and then they pay us. And based on the statistics we have there, we're averaging about $4 million on the vendor program. And that, again, is subject to change based on a variety of different situations. Finally, one of the things that we also did was the Treasury does publish a report that shows comparisons of state agencies and the net collections from the Treasury program. And we looked at the results they published for two states that are currently doing the reciprocal program. So that would be the pieces that we would need to add, that vendor piece that we don't currently have. And based on the results that the federal government or the treasurer presented, it does show that Maryland had $8 million in December of 2009. This is calendar years, and $4 million in December of 2010. We did verify with the state, or with the IRS as well, on those particular figures, and we do have a call into Maryland to find out more about how they're administering that program. So when you look at Maryland's results, according to the report that's published in the feds, $47.7 million was the result of individual or income tax or tax refunds that were offset. So that was another factor that we took into consideration. Our results, as I mentioned, are significantly lower, and there's some reasons why that, and I'll talk about that here in just a minute. Some of the reasons why our numbers may be lower than other states based on what we're currently doing and because of the revenue estimate is because we do have to give that taxpayer that notification, which requires us to wait 60 days, and oftentimes the debts are resolved before we can even submit them because of all the changes that we've made in our system and where we've automated a lot of things to try to resolve debts and get on top of them quicker. As I mentioned earlier, there is a requirement from the feds that say that you cannot send the debt until it's 6 months old. Debts for us are often resolved within that time frame. We do have many collection tools at our discretion that are used in conjunction with the federal offset, and oftentimes they resolve the debt or at least decrease the liability owing, resulting in less money from the offset program. Most of the time, if somebody is entitled to a federal refund, they're also entitled to a state refund, and we will typically offset that state refund, resulting in less money owing, which results then in less money from the offset program. And finally, Maryland is in close proximity to the federal government, and this may result in more businesses in Maryland having federal contracts, therefore making more money available through the vendor reciprocal agreement. And there's a couple additional closing comments I would like to make. When we did the fiscal note, one of the things we did make an assumption on, we would be more than happy to work with you on language, but one of the things we made the assumption on is that this would apply to both tax and non-tax debt. However, the language that is currently written is only under 16D, and 16D is the statute that allows us to do other agency debt collections. So we're kind of questioning whether or not it would apply to both tax and non-tax, so we would be happy to work with you on language to get that incorporated into 270C so we can make sure we can do it for both the tax and the non-tax debt. And then finally, we did not itemize the fee. The current language talks about a rulemaking to incorporate a fee. We do have some existing language that would allow us to use fees that we could emulate into the statute if we have an opportunity to work with you, but we did not itemize the fee or the cost because we, as what happens today in our current offset program, that fee offsets the expenses related to that. So, for example, you have to send notifications by certified mail. And if you don't do that, you're not able to qualify for the program. So we have some fees associated with that. Also, MMB has to administer the vendor component of that, so there would be some administrative costs for them as well, such as picking up the file transfer and some of the phone calls. So with that, I will open it up for questions.
And did you wish to have Mr. Scheide?
We can take otherwise questions on... if there are questions on data analytics for Mr. Cheetah. Otherwise, just in closing, Mr. Chair, we really appreciate your time. The mission of our agency is to make sure the tax system works well for Minnesota, and we understand that Minnesota faces a significant budget challenge and that state agencies need to be partners in not only that solution, but also in identifying solutions that work, and we do welcome the opportunity to continue working with you and the committee on proposals as we move forward.
Well, thank you. Ms. Steenblok, we would welcome suggested amendment language that that you mentioned in your comments. I appreciate the chance to meet with you folks here recently and talk about other tools that might be made available to you to help do your compliance work. And I appreciate your openness to the whole issue of tax analytics, and appreciated the fact that you acknowledge that you don't have the tools or the expertise that may be needed to identify all of the folks who need to be audited, and that that you were open to the possibility of engaging outside firms that have the more sophistication, more capacity to do that sort of analysis, as they've done it in other locations. I guess I'd like you to respond. I mean, the governor's proposal here is to add another $43,500,000 for compliance. I assume that the intent here is basically the same kind of another round like we've had in recent years for adding additional staff to do this. Have you considered? I mean, I know you're considering it now because we've asked you to. But have you considered along the way maybe asking for the authorization to get some more sophisticated help here? You know, when you look at some of the, especially some of the corporate interests out there, they have very high-level expertise available to them in terms of accounting and legal and all the rest, and they can figure out every conceivable way to minimize the amount of tax that they pay. And I worry about our capacity as a department to outmatch some of that expertise that's out there. As I shared with you in private, the proposal that we have from the governor doesn't really address that, does it?
Mr. Chair and members, I'm going to invite Mr. Cheetah to join in on the tax analytics, but I think in general, I think that as we have made improvements in the GenTax system, that each successive tax compliance initiative that we take on benefits from the improvements that we're making in our systems. You know, I think there are some in terms of international business activities and that sort of thing. There are some other issues that perhaps that we have talked about that we will continue to look at. That is a unique expertise that states don't have, or our state doesn't have in-house, and we'll continue to look at that. But that is not part of the governor's proposal. But I'm going to let Mr. Cheetah respond as well.
Mr. Cheetah.
Chairman Manning, committee members, my name is Greg Cheetah. I'm with the Minnesota Department of Revenue out of the Office of the CIO. And one of the things that I have been charged with over the past few years is our data warehouse and taking a look at business intelligence tools and data mining and those types of things. We are constantly looking at new tools and new ways of doing our work, particularly in the compliance area. Earlier, you received testimony with Representative Pepin from the SAS Institute. We've actually looked at the SAS Institute and came very close to purchasing some of their suite of tools. We do use SAS tools for some of this work right now. We have, as you all know, because you gave us the funding for it, been implementing over the past 3 years a new integrated tax system. And we are learning the functionality that can really help us. We've also spent the last 3 years consolidating all of our data into a very integrated data warehouse so that we can be better and better able to utilize this data to do these things. We are always open. We listen to vendors constantly and try and make decisions as to what tools or what services can we purchase to take a look at. We have also worked with the University of Minnesota in their applied mathematics with a professor there who is a national expert in the use of data mining, and worked with some of his doctoral candidates doing some pilot studies of true data mining in an audit setting, and some of you know that we have actually won an award for our work with that. Actually, in last October, working with our senior management, we started to say, this is something that really should start taking a look at developing this expertise inside the Department of Revenue, this high-level analytic capability. I contacted the University of Minnesota. They were very, very interested in partnering with us, and I was working with the professor to try and define what were the knowledge, skills, and abilities we should put together as we were to create a position to actually start this going forward. Unfortunately, at the same time, because of some other issues, there was a freeze on hiring, and so a lot of that has been shelved. And the only reason I say is that's last October, before the legislation started, before any of this is going on. So it is something that we are very, very interested in doing and pursuing, and in many ways, you know, partnering with the University of Minnesota, taking a look at the tools that are available. I have also done a number of things. There's a Federation of Tax Administrators. They have some listservs. We have put, you know, how have other people done this? What are their experiences? And I've got some information from them. Again, this was back in the October-November time frame, taking a look at how to make this actually occur. So I guess I'd like to assure the committee and the chairman that we are very interested in any tools that are available to us, and we need to take a look at that and balance it and say, what is the best way for us to accomplish our mission? And we're open to everything.
Well, thank you, Mr. Cheetah. And you folks do a great job when it comes to the compliance. And what my goal is, what our goal is to help you do an even better job. And just hiring some auditors that are relatively inexperienced in the field is no match for what we're up against in the very sophisticated world nowadays. And so we need to be looking at tools that can help you do an even better job when it comes to determining who should be audited and whether to make sure people are paying the taxes that they should be paying. Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Excuse my voice. You know, just curious, I guess, I don't think that we've got sophisticated financial and legal resources at major companies who are trying to avoid paying taxes that they legally owe. I think they are trying to come up with novel arguments and ways of avoiding paying taxes within the legal system. So I would argue that noncompliance isn't the issue so much as you know, creative litigation over the tax system. I just want to return to a couple points that Mr. Mossman made to make sure I got it. I know one piece of information I missed. So to start out with, the revenue department's budget reduction, I think you said was 15% for your operating, which is basically your voluntary compliance element of your department. Is that accurate?
Mr. Mossman?
Mr. Chair and members, our budget, there's a couple of reductions in the bill that we believe will impact the agency, obviously, but there's the specified 15% reduction to the agency, which is $39.7 million for the biennium.
Okay.
And Frank, thank you. That is across the board. It's across the whole agency, the 15% cut.
Okay. And Mr. Chair, Mr.
Representative Winkler.
Mossman, that, so, but that obviously is offset by the additional tax compliance initiative that the governor is proposing and is included in this bill. And I always think of the Department of Revenue as basically divided between your tax compliance initiatives and your, you know, agency operations. But to the kind of core of your agency, it's a 15% reduction. And you said that there was a, I think you said, a $111 million revenue loss to the state associated with that reduction. I wonder if you could, expand on that a bit.
Mr. Mossman?
Mr. Chair and members, Representative Winkler, I think the way to think about it is, or at least one way to think about it, is that in the past, we've been getting resources, obviously, for tax compliance, and about 70% of our budget supports direct tax compliance activities. And so if we were to take a 15% reduction in our budget, our assumption is, and this is consistent with what our assumption in allocating budget reductions has always been, is that we would have some revenue loss because as a result we would be doing less tax compliance efforts from the tax compliance initiatives that have been previously adopted by the legislature for and that the agency's been directed to do. So that's where how we arrive at the estimate of the $111 million revenue loss based on the 15% reduction. The bill does appropriate additional resources to the agency with the expectation that the agency generate $133 million of additional revenue. I think a way to think about it is that if we aren't also taking a look at what the impact of the cut would be, then what in effect in the appropriation and revenue assumption that's in the bill is about a 4-to-1 assumption. If we didn't also take a look at the cut, you would kind of by definition be assuming that would be about an 8-to-1 return that you would be asking us to make on the money, the new resources that are being appropriated in the bill.
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Mosman, I don't know. Obviously, we've got a spreadsheet, and we are identifying cuts, and we have tax compliance assumptions built into the language of the bill. Is this something that we would see as a fiscal note or a revenue note? Not really sure how this interplay, I guess, works with this bill and the actual net effect on revenue generated for the state. I don't know if that revenue generation should appear as in this committee's target or, how will we account for those reductions?
Mr. Mosman?
Mr. Chair and Representative Winkler, we don't generally do, I don't think, a fiscal note on the overall bill that you have before you, or we'll clean one up as we move forward. But what we have put together, are doing more work on and can provide to the committee later today, is a spreadsheet that summarizes what we believe are the impacts of the bill on the agency and on the general fund. We do believe that the $111 million and that there would be an additional revenue loss, that revenue loss should be reflected in legislative tracking or in the overall impact of what the bill would have on the state budget. And in addition, we believe that there will be some additional revenue loss as a result of what we assume will be some additional reductions in the agency as a result of the employee reductions that MMB is expected to manage, and to the extent we have some of those reductions.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Winkler,
and Mr. Mosman, you gave a number for associated with that $94 million reduction, and I wonder if, and I missed that, and I wonder if you could just restate that.
Actually, Mr. Chair and members, I actually didn't give a number related to the $94 million. That's a number that we would like a little bit of additional time to clean up. We do think it will be an order of magnitude. I'm assuming similar to the $111 million, but we would like to make sure we have a fair estimate of what the Department of Revenue's impacts will be as a result of the MMB reductions.
And Mr. Chair, just
Representative Winkler,
final point I want us to be clear. So the fiscal note for the federal offset, you're showing a net revenue gain to the state of $4.3 million. And, Mr. Chair, I believe that the bill contains an estimate of $36 million for that federal offset program. And I guess the question to you, Mr. Chair, is are we going to change that $36 million? Is there going to be an amendment to do that, or are we going to, I guess, regard or disregard the official fiscal note for that provision?
Well, Representative Winkler, we did not have the fiscal note when that number was the best information that we had available, and now we have a fiscal note, and we've heard the explanation, thorough explanation as to how that was achieved. I guess that's quite a swing, and there's going to have to be some reconciling of this. And I think very well this may have to be something reconciled in ways and means that I don't know how we can reconcile that here. I wanted to also comment on the $111 million estimated loss in revenue because of reductions to the department. I want to call members' attention to the language on page 6 of the bill that says, to the greatest extent possible, the commissioner must avoid making budget reduction to compliance activities. Very clearly, compliance activities are going to be affected by these reductions, no question about it. But the bill says to minimize those as much as possible. And Mr. Mossman and I had an opportunity to briefly talk before the hearing today, and I was referring to this handout that we had as a committee back when. If you look for the first in fiscal 10 and 11, the first compliance we had, we provided an additional $10.4 million, which resulted in actual revenues of 41.5. I don't know how many additional auditors were acquired or added to the staff as a result of the 10.4, but I would hope that the $111 million is calculated the same way as this is calculated, in terms of for every 10, 20, 40, 50 people added, you would expect that much additional revenue. We need to have some consistency here, it seems to me. And I would look forward to hearing more from the department with respect to how you really calculated the $111 million and how it compares with how we've calculated the return from previous commitments that we've made to add additional compliance activity. So, Mr. Mossman?
Sure. Mr. Chair and members, that's a very fair question. And I think that, first of all, as the order of magnitude climbs, I think that the calculation gets a bit more concerning as well to us, in terms of how it relates to the tax, the table, and the previous tax compliance initiatives that you're referring to. In terms of the $111 million estimate, the 15% reduction is assumed to be a reduction across the board to our agency, and so the estimate is based on of the revenue loss is based on just that portion that falls on direct compliance initiatives, that portion of the 15% cut that falls on the direct compliance portions of our budget, which is about 70% of our budget. And that is assumed to be a revenue loss at the same four to one ratio that we are currently engaging in tax compliance efforts. So we do believe that the methodology lines up with where we're at right now on tax compliance initiatives. Recognizing the language in the bill, Mr. Chairman, and just wanting to speak a little bit to that, we do recognize that the bill encourages us and directs us to, as best possible, to avoid direct tax compliance initiatives. I think the challenge that we face as an agency would be that at a 15% reduction level, while 30% of our budget is not related to direct tax compliance efforts, it's a pretty critical part of our budget, because it supports pretty much all of the voluntary tax compliance efforts of the tax collections that we do for the state of Minnesota. It supports our tax research, legal services and appeals. It supports tax collections and processing. So it supports a significant functionality of our agency. And as the budget reduction for those parts of the agency climbs, we get to a point where we're no longer able to assume that we can continue to make reductions solely to that part of the agency. So in this case, we do assume that the 15% reduction would be across the board to the agency.
Thank you. Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Mossman, that's a perfect segue into what I was going to ask, which is what I've asked previous testifiers. Could you give us a little bit of a sense or a flavor of what would then happen if an additional 12% of your workforce were basically let go? Is the 12% figure here, assuming, which I know we can't with any precision, but just assuming for now that we're talking about 12% pro rata across the agencies, if you were given by the Dayton administration a 12% figure, a pro rata share of the overall global 12% cut to the state workforce, what then would be the impact, first, on the agency in general, and second, since I heard you with some precision talk about how you can allocate it among the 70% versus the 30%, second part of my question is, could you say with respect to compliance what effect a 12% workforce cut would have with respect to compliance? So first part of the question is generally as to the Department of Revenue. Second, what would a 12% whack in the workforce have when it comes to compliance?
Representative Simon, I hope your question isn't assuming that it's a 15% cut in the budget and then on top of that another 12% in terms of workforce. I hope you're not assuming that with your question.
Mr. Chair, I was assuming that because that's a possibility.
Representative Simon, as I said yesterday, my interpretation of this would be that the whatever staff reduction is required through these budget reductions counts towards the goal of 12% reduction in workforce for the coming biennium and another 3% beyond. we're not intending here to make all of these reductions and then on top of that add additional staff reductions. The staff reductions are coming as a part of the budget recommendation and count towards the achieving the goal of 12% in the next biennium. Mr. Mossman.
Mr. Chair and members and Representative Simon, and we do look forward to learning more, Mr. Chair, and understanding how the 12% interacts with the 15% reduction. As we arrived at committee today, I think it was as well our understanding that the way the bill read that the 12% would be in addition to the 15% reduction to the agency. So we look forward, we'll talk more with you and make sure we understand that correctly as we refine our estimates of revenue loss. But to Representative Simon's questions, a few of the things that we think we would see significant changes in as a result of the reductions to the agency. We do think that there would be reductions, delays in processing times for tax returns. As we tailor the amount of resources we allocate to that and extend the time that tax returns are processed, that there would be a total elimination of performance measurement activities. There would be a significant decrease in our technology renewal, increasing our risk to data loss and disruption to taxpayers potentially. We would have a reduction to human resources and to our direct tax compliance staff that handle administrative work. We would have a reduction to our appeal staff, which would further delay our legal appeals, tax appeals, which have been a concern to some as well as to us. We would have some reduction to tax research staff, and that is staff that supports both the executive branch agency and the legislative branch, certainly in terms of its policy making, in terms of giving research and revenue estimates that are needed to make decisions. We would have a large reduction in property tax oversight, and so we would become certainly more dependent on local governments to follow property tax laws without the benefit of oversight and uniformity and continuity of that oversight from the state level. Those are, I think, those are in addition to what I think would be some major changes just in tax auditing staff and the direct compliance efforts that we previously talked about.
Mr. Shepard, would you comment on my interpretation of the language here?
Mr. Chair and members, I agree with your interpretation of the language. I think that the requirement for a 15% reduction is independent of whatever reduction in appropriations the committee makes, so that if the committee made only a if the final bill enacted into law required only a 5% reduction in appropriations, the agency would still be obligated to cut its workforce by 12% this biennium and 15% in the next biennium. But there's no, I don't believe there's any requirement that the 15% reduction be in addition to the reductions in appropriations. So that would be something that if the reduction in appropriations were 12% and an agency met that by reducing their workforce by 12%, they would be done, in my opinion.
Thank you, Mr. Shepard. Next is Representative Banyan. Wrong list. Representative Murray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I believe maybe Ms. Steinbeck-Block could answer this question. Did I hear you correctly that we have 50,000 businesses that you're looking at for revenue? Or could you tell me those numbers again and also what you're collecting for other agencies? I'd like to know the number of firms out there you're working with first.
Mr. Chair.
Ms. Steinbeck.
The number that we gave you is based on those that would qualify for the vendor offset program. And when we say 50,000 debts, that means one taxpayer could have multiple debts. So if they were audited multiple years or they failed to pay over multiple years, one taxpayer could have numerous debts. So that was just based on, you know, looking at the language for the vendor offset program, who would potentially qualify, and would be businesses. So we just looked at the number of business debts that were there. As far as the total number of cases or debts that we have within the agency, I didn't bring that with me, but I can give you that figure. The other agency debt figure, that 3,000 that we gave, those again were just debts that we currently have that would qualify for the vendor offset program. Now, when I say qualify, it's just they're a business. It doesn't necessarily mean they would qualify for the program because, as I mentioned earlier, some of them don't do federal contracting and wouldn't necessarily, we wouldn't be able to, we wouldn't receive any funds as a result of those.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Murray.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Steinbeck, I was also wondering then if you could get us the total of what is the uncollected revenue out there? Roughly how old is that revenue? So what's the aging on it? Mm-hmm. What's the likelihood of collecting that debt? And would you happen to know, does it approach $5.1
billion? No, it does not.
Okay.
Thank you. I can get you. We do have those stats. I can give you the gross and the net and the aging of the debts.
Okay. Appreciate that. Thank you.
Shucks. Representative Downey.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just an observation as the entities are responding to Representative Simon's question. Kind of as per usual, we're all talking about the things that citizens might actually value and the things that, you know, gain some notoriety in their absence. And very few of them have talked about any of our ideas about consolidating the back office functions. Very few of them have mentioned consolidating technology functions or outsourcing. These cuts are, of course, automatically assumed to go directly to the high-value citizen-facing functions, and that's just, I think, a classic tendency of public sector organizations to defend their value. And I challenge them to take a look at the back office and the other things that they're doing that maybe aren't as high-value add before they come in and offer their comments about where they'd cut. And another observation, and I liked your line of questioning, Mr. Chair, about why the ratio of the absence of people translates into a bigger number for tax compliance lost. And an observation of mine is we spent a ton of money putting in a new integrated tax system, and from what I can tell, have gained zero efficiencies except on the non-compliance activities. And at some point in time, we got to gain some efficiencies on the compliance side, too. We have, I think, for the last 3 years, been estimating about 4 to 1 in terms of the dollars of tax compliance returned for every dollar we spend on people in the initiative. And the governor's proposal basically assumed we just got to add more people. And I think our proposals are saying, number one, this integrated tax compliance software system has to pay dividends at some point in time. At some point in time, we have to be able to get more tax compliance revenue for the effort by being more targeted, fairer to businesses and people who are being audited, and actually achieving a better result. So I think there's and we've tried to add new technology tools and new capabilities in this bill as well to get at some of those efficiencies. So I for one, just don't accept the pat answer that somehow these formulas we've always used are the ones that we should use with these notes and these assumptions. And boy, if we don't get any efficiencies and any better at tax compliance after this new software system, then I think we've got to ask a question about what we did with it and why we even made the investment in the first place. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So, Mr. Mossman, did you wish to respond?
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Downey, I'll do so delicately because I know your intent is for us to find efficiencies, and as I testified earlier, I think we have genuinely been an agency that has initiated a number of nation-leading efficiencies over the years and are continue to be open to doing that. And I'm learning some of this as having recently joined the agency as well, but just a few things to kind of add to your reference of the back office functions. The Department of Revenue has one payroll person, one purchasing person, and one accounts a payable person for 1,500 employees. So we're trying to get a better understanding of, as well, I think, as to what sort of efficiencies are expected to be found in the agency. I think just in general, a 15% reduction in the workforce is going of any agency, I think, but certainly just speaking with ours, is going to have some impact on what that agency does and what it can do in the future. And so that, I think, is the tenor. We certainly want to continue to be helpful and find efficiencies and find better ways of doing things, but I think there's some reality to that reduction also and having significance to what our mission is and how we can achieve it.
Got two more on the list here, and then we need to move on. Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, just a comment to respond to Representative Downey. I think that it's fair to expect some return on investment for the new system. I think that's a fair point. But I think we can overestimate the extent in compliance to which technology is really our savior here. I think a lot of times it is people. It is subjective human judgments. As I've said before, I represented the Department of Revenue in the 90s when I was in the Attorney General's office, and these are just people questions. No computer can decide whether a cell phone manufacturer a cell phone company claiming to be a manufacturer should be entitled to a tax break. That was a case I worked on for about a year. A cell phone company in Minnesota was claiming a huge capital equipment deduction that was intended for manufacturers, and it claimed, we get it. We're entitled to that. And it was worth tens of millions of dollars. Why? Because we're a manufacturing company. We're a cell phone carrier. And we fought that all the way to the Minnesota Supreme Court. I don't know of any software program that can determine whether the Department of Revenue should or should not pursue that. Similarly, with residency cases, we've seen a lot of cases recently in the media in the last few years of people who are living in Minnesota, enjoying everything in Minnesota, but claiming they're Wisconsin residents. I had cases of people who were clearly Alaska residents, but claimed that they were Minnesota residents, even though they voted in Alaska, had hunting and fishing licenses in Alaska, had family in Alaska, had homes in Alaska, or in Minnesota, rather, reverse that. They had everything in Minnesota, but claimed that they were Alaska residents. They voted in Minnesota, had property in Minnesota, hunting and fishing licenses here, worshipped here, claimed they were Alaska residents. I just don't know of any software program that's going to get us there. So at a granular level, this is about people. And I just don't see any way in the real world that a software program is going to reform our way out of this. That's not to say we shouldn't expect a return on investment in a software program. We should. But in the real world of that department, which I inhabited for 3 years as part of the Attorney General's office, I'm telling you, software is not going to do the job. And if that's what we mean by reform around here, that it's just, you know, fire people, buy more software and computers, and cutting means reforming, then I think people are just going to laugh at us. And deservedly so. So I think we ought to get real here. This naive assumption that software and computers are going to do everything, it's just, it's a joke. It's not true. It's not the real world. I've been there, and it's not the real world.
Representative Spencer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think some of those are valid points. We have to be careful in some of our assumptions. I think you have to look for data in terms of, you know, where are the results. And I'm just wondering, too, the testifiers. I know Wisconsin has done some tax analytics, and they've been quite successful. And I just know in some of the summaries, I'm certainly not an expert at tax analytics, but it seems to me, I think in 7 years, they recovered over $400 million in tax revenues using a tax analytics software program. And that, my rough math, is like $57 million per year. And that seems like a great quantifiable return. So I think we need to maximize our people and leveraging the technology. And I'm wondering, have you studied that? I know I was disappointed that there wasn't, I don't know if it was a no fiscal note on the tax analytics or if they actually did come back with a zero return. Because I think we all need to work smarter. And if we have fewer people, if we can maximize our opportunity on those most likely to owe us taxes. And just any comments and background on that would be great.
Chairman, Mr. Representative, we are very familiar with the work with the Wisconsin Department of Revenue and their data mining process. I speak with them on a regular basis. They are using a product, and I would assume the numbers, I'm not sure where you got the numbers, I would assume they probably came from the SAS Institute again because they bought the SAS suite. So they're giving you what they have gotten through their data warehousing, data mining process. Very nice lady named Jana Baggins is the one who's in charge of that over there. That would be the same as we do with our data warehouse and what we have done with some of the use of data to create collections and the rest. And so while they will attribute it to one set of tools, we will attribute it to our warehouse in a whole lot. And, you know, I could, I suppose, stand up here and say we brought in $625 million last year based on our data because just about every one of our audit selection things uses data in our data warehouse. I don't see where that helps in the discussion. As I said before, the high-end analytics that we are talking about here, that's a little separate from that. You know, there's lots of different tools that you can use and the rest. So, yes, I'm very interested, and I believe the department is very interested in the use of analytics. Representative Simon, you really need three things for analytics, okay? You need experts in the department who truly understand, your best auditors, to sit there and kind of validate and you tap into what they are doing, okay? You also need good data, what's in our data mining, our data warehouse, clean data together so that you can integrate it so that you can take multiple different data sources. We have over 1,000 different tables in our data warehouse right now that get joined to do this type of work. And then you need sophisticated tools and knowledge on statistics and how to create the models and the algorithms and the rest. That creates the list of things, candidates, and you're completely constantly refining them. But that creates a better list of candidates, potentially, that you can go to. Bottom line is somebody still has to go out and do the audit and somebody still has to do the collection, and it really falls to people. All right. Now, can we be more efficient and can we automate some of that stuff? Yes, and we're constantly taking a look at pieces like that. So it's a very complex, it's a very big thing, and as I've offered previously, anybody would like to come over, I'm more than willing to because we're kind of proud of what we are doing, and show them what we've got and some of the things that we really want to try and accomplish.
Representative Downey, and then we're going to move on.
Well, Mr. Chair, just an observation. I can't pull out the chart, but my recollection from the department's presentation when they first came in was that the number of people in their customer service area had dropped substantially over the last 6 to 8 years. So very clearly, in their department, they have been able to take advantage of new processes, methods, technology to get better on that side of it, and yet the compliance side just continues to climb and climb and climb. And I think what we've heard over and over again is that with this new integrated tax system, we're going to have new capabilities and new ways to do things better. I think it's time that we, as compared to simply just throwing more bodies at tax compliance to get that incremental dollar of revenue, that we actually ask some questions about, you know, what is this new system providing us? And if the addition of all of these other systems doesn't give you much of an incremental value in what you're doing compared to your current system, then I think we should have an even stronger conversation about what is this new system providing you. We've got to be able to find those kinds of efficiencies as well, and it isn't just about technology. It's about getting better using the information and the technology that we have, and I think our bill is attempting to provide an advance on the analytics side and on the technology side on top of what you've already done to start getting a better bang for the buck. So I think the combination of this, we're just going to continue to have to have a 1-to-4 ratio between compliance expenditures to return on that investment, and then coming back with the exact reverse situation to, you know, compensate for your budget cuts. It just doesn't add up, and I think there's an opportunity there that we're missing somewhere.
Well, Mr. Shannon.
Representative Kahn, quickly, please.
Yes. Well, the reason, and, you know, you were here for the drawing up of the last appropriation bills we did, so it's kind of inexcusable for you to say this. But the reason why other things dropped was that we always held the compliance efforts, and this was done with the tax agreement of the tax commissioner, the commissioner of that department from the previous administration, so it's not a big DFL plot, where we kept the compliance efforts high, and they had to cut back on everything. And if you haven't heard complaints from people about the tax services having been, you know, they understand it's pretty good, but they understand that they've seen decreases in that. I mean, I don't know. I guess maybe Edina's different than Minneapolis. But it's, you know, that's been the reason why other things have been cut and compliance hasn't. Because we specifically, I bet we even stated it in the bill. But we'll have to go look at that.
Well, thank you very much for being here today, and we look forward to continuing this discussion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Next, we're going to call on Lucinda Winter. Welcome, and please identify yourself for the record.
Good morning, Chair Lanning and members of the committee. Okay. My name is Lucinda Winter, and I am the Executive Director of the Minnesota Film and Television Board. I keep my remarks very, very brief. I have two reasons for being here today. Number one is to thank you because you held our funds for our office harmless in the budget bill, and I am very appreciative of that. We are at the same funding level that we've been at for many years. We managed to do our jobs very well, even with increasing demand on that with that amount and with the private funds that we match the public funds with. So thank you very much for that. The reason I'm here. My second reason for being here today is to ask you on behalf of the people who work in our industry, that's about 4,000 people who work in Minnesota in production. There are about 400 businesses that work in production, and in addition to those businesses that do post-production, production animation, computer graphics, all the things that are many companies in Minnesota use as part of their marketing money, to ask you to reconsider funding our Snowbait program. It's the Minnesota Film Jobs Production Program, and the reason that I'm asking this, in full recognition of the challenges you face in both eliminating a very tough deficit and trying to encourage private job creation, is because, as I say in my leave behind here, Snowbait, since 2007, has a proven track record as an efficient job creation tool. Since July of the year when we were given an appropriation for our Minnesota Film Jobs production program, we've created almost 500 jobs. That's 493 full-time equivalent jobs here in Minnesota for Minnesotans. We've, on about a $4 million total Minnesota investment, brought an additional $26,500,000 into our state at a cost per job of about $8,000, which compares very favorably with other states. It's a very small investment, but we would, even in this tough time, we'd like to continue a program that we know works. We'd like to continue to bring new business to Minnesota and to help maintain the infrastructure that's here because of the increased business we bring in. One, and I do want to dispel the myth that this is about bringing Hollywood to Minnesota, which then runs away with the money. We have not had one studio film in Minnesota since this program started. The closest we got was the Coen Brothers, and they are they're funded basically outside the studio system. That was the closest we got. I have circulated one sample of the kinds of business that we attract to Minnesota with Snowbait. In this case, I took television. We have a lot of TV series production in our state, most of it national and international cable. For those of you who don't know, Bizarre Foods with Andrew Zimmern is seen in almost every country in the world. You can go into Africa and somebody living in a tent who has a little antenna sticking out with a pie pan on it, and that's what they're using for an antenna, they will be getting some of this cable programming. It's amazing, and also through satellite. So it's raising our profile. It's creating jobs for people in Minnesota who come in and out of offices every day. The medium wage for our industry is $44,000 a year, according to the Department of Labor. So I am asking that, even though I know it's a really tough ask, that we at least support this program through the deficit so that we don't completely go dark. It's in a really important tool for people in Minnesota to compete with Vancouver's of the world, Toronto's of the world, Portland, all the other places, Chicago, New York, other places where people can make these programs. Our people here are competing with them, and this is a really important competitive tool. And that's those are my remarks.
Ms. Winter, again, what was the amount of the request?
The governor recommended $1 million for a program. And during the last 4 years, it's varied a little bit, but we've usually gotten about 1.225 per year. And just so you do know, our current Snowbait funds, the last of our funds, were just earmarked for a film written by a Minnesotan that's shooting right now in in Minneapolis and in Bloomington, St. Louis Park, Minnetonka. They're shooting at the airport, which that means revenue to the MAC. They're shooting in a lot of different places for the next month and a half.
Representative Erdahl? I'm sorry, Winkler was first. I'm sorry.
I think, Mr. Chair, we may be asking about some of the same questions. Ms. Winter, I just want to make sure I understand it. Is the $1 million figure on the governor's recommendation, is that exclusively for the Snowbait program?
Yes.
And if so, what other sources of funds do you have to operate the film board?
Ms. Winter?
Chair Manning and Representative Winkler, we have two little checking accounts. One is the state money we receive to run our office annually, which is $325,000. That money is only received after we match it with private funds on a 1-to-3 match. So if someone gives, if, for example, Best Buy is a supporter, Best Buy company, when they give us their annual contribution, then we can go to the state with proof of contribution and receive our state money. So that's one, and that runs through tourism, support funded through a grant through tourism. Snowbait is completely separate. And we do receive a 5% administrative fee for running Snowbait, which I use basically to, I have one person who is a full-time Snowbait administrator, because when we are looking at people's, that's another good thing about our program, is absolutely no taxpayer money is paid out until the economic activity occurs and is audited. It's checked by us. It's audited by us. Literally, I see every, not I, Jill and I see every receipt. We know that so-and-so spent $500 at the Target on 36 and 100, and that's how we track spending. We also have, we can look at payroll records, so we know how much Minnesota income tax is paid. And the program also benefits our state because whether you're a Minnesotan and you're getting the rebate on those Minnesota workers, or you're from out of state and you come in to work on the movie, you're paying Minnesota income taxes while you're here. So we're benefiting from that income tax collection, but not rebating people from out of state. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Winter, I just want to understand kind of basic line items. So the Explore Minnesota Tourism gives you a $325,000 matching grant for your operations, and then we've got the $1 million Snowbay program, which is a separate line item. The budget. And I guess my final question is whether you have received or are looking to receive legacy funds.
We have made,
Ms. Winter?
Chair Lanning and Representative Winkler, we have made a request on the House side for funds from legacy, and we are preparing a bill for the Senate side. And just so you know, since you did ask, we would like to have that be a grant program, not a reimbursement program. And that grant program, which would be similar to one that is being run in Louisiana and one in New Mexico, would specifically be grants for some portion of the production costs for Minnesota filmmakers who are making small budget Minnesota films, be they documentaries or films. So the really, in the true spirit of what those funds were intended for, that would support Minnesota artists who seek to express their stories, Minnesota stories, whether they're of historic significance or in some way significant in terms of our heritage. Those funds would go to support those programs. It would be administered through our office since we're already in the administrative game with film. We know how to make that work.
Mr. Chair, just a final question.
Representative.
And that's whether any of the legacy grant program funds that you're seeking would be an alternative to the Snowbait tax credit program. So in other words, would anybody who currently is eligible for Snowbait be also eligible for the film production grants that you're seeking legacy funds for, if there's any crossover?
So our
Ms. Winter?
Chair Lanning and Representative, are you asking whether someone could apply to both? Is that what you're asking?
Well, let me get to
Representative
the
Winkler.
Point. Is eliminating the Snowbait funding being made up for by creating a legacy fund for film production in Minnesota? In other words, is the grant program supplanting the Snowbait program in any way?
Ms. Winter?
Chair Lanning and Representative Winkler, my honest answer is that these are two legs of a stool that we need both. The reason is because one has a very heavy economic development burden. With the Snowbait funds, as in other states and countries that have similar programs, you are trying to encourage people to come into your state and those who work who are in your states to stay there and bring the work that they have into the state. And we are very much into proving the economic impact and the jobs creation there. The legacy money, while it would certainly, there's no question that jobs would be created, it depends on how you craft your grant program. But one would be a grant program, and one would be a reimbursement for costs.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. Ms. Winter, how many years have you received Snowbait money?
Ms. Winter?
Chair Lanning and Representative Erdahl, our program was funded and online in July of 2007. So it was fiscal year, I always get confused, I think that was 2006. We got the funds and then we fired it up in July of 2007. You could start applying.
Representative Erdahl?
Chair Lanning, Ms. Winter, and have you received funding every year since then?
This funding has always been available until expended. And the Snowbait funds that we just earmarked and have now, now our checkbook is empty, were from fiscal year 2010. We did not receive funds in 2011 because they were vetoed.
Representative Erdahl.
Mr. Chairman and Ms. Winter, the funding levels have varied. Is this correct?
They,
Ms. Winter?
Yes, that's true. Not significantly, but yes, they have varied.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Erdahl.
So, technically, it's not a traditional source of funding because sometimes you don't get it and sometimes it varies.
That is, yes, that is true. It's difficult for us to attract, to continue to attract business because the people that we work with, sometimes the sales cycle for this kind of thing can be 6 months to a year long, sometimes longer. And if someone is considering our state and let's say three other states, they want to know that those funds are going to be available. So it's difficult for us to continue marketing and selling when, and in many states, these sorts of programs have a sunset that is 15, 20 years out. So it is difficult for us to have funds that are not, we can't count on being available. That is true.
Just one comment.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to say that I think it's unfortunate that we have films being written in Minnesota, about Minnesota, and then they're filmed someplace else.
Mm-hmm.
For example, Representative Lilly was just mentioning a movie that I don't recall the name of now, set in New Ulm and filmed in Canada.
Correct. Yes, there. It was called Our Town, or that was, yeah. That I think the really, just to answer your question, the really good example would be, for example, Gran Torino, written by a Minnesotan about a very much a Minnesota story of the changing nature of our population and the impacts it has on people. And that went to Michigan. If I may, Chair Lanning, just to address, readdress not only Representative Erdahl, but Representative Winkler as well. Were we not to have snowbait funds, with, there are films that would fit within the parameters of the legacy money that would certainly not only support Minnesota filmmakers, but ensure that those stories are told here. All I'm saying is, in a perfect world, which we're obviously, clearly we're not in, it would be great to be able to offer your Minnesota filmmakers a grant program and that would fit, and we have such a unique opportunity with our constitutional money. But were we to not receive snowbait funds going forward, we would try to craft a program out of legacy funds that would ensure that the kinds of things that the instances like Representative Erdahl are talking about don't happen, where Minnesota filmmakers have to choose not to tell those stories here, get them made here.
Representative Erdahl, the folks from Back Up My Way would make the same argument about the movie Fargo that had only one brief scene actually filmed in the city of Fargo. Much of it was in Minnesota.
Is it the Witcher scene?
No. As I recall, it was a bar scene.
No, the bar scene was filmed in Minnesota.
Well, whatever.
It was filmed in my district, in a place that has been taken down and should have been subject.
Representative Kahn.
Okay. Actually, that was just a spontaneous outbreak. But what I really want to say is that it would be a great shame and a great disgrace to this state that when Representative Erdahl's trilogy is turned into film, that it is not filmed in Minnesota. and that if that happened under our watch, that would just be disgraceful.
I would agree.
Well,
you don't want us to, Representative Erdahl?
Well,
earmark it.
Yes and no. Because if it was filmed some other place, I could get money from it. I would have a hard time collecting money from something in Minnesota that I had written. Okay. From this committee.
Oh.
Representative Simon, and then we need to move on, folks.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Real quickly, first, when you talked about snowbait as opposed to the grant, you were talking about, at the very beginning of your presentation, you talked about the film infrastructure that already exists in Minnesota. I think that's a point worth emphasizing because it's not as if these are just bands of filmmakers that come into the state, you know, shop at our stores, eat at our restaurants, stay at our hotels, and then leave. We have people here year-round who work for Hollywood and basically do the filmmaking, whether it's location scouts or editors of various kinds. Could you just kind of describe that briefly? Because I think that's an important point.
Ms. Winter?
Yes, I'd be happy to. Chair Lanning and Representative Simon, we are not Arkansas. We are a state with a significant production industry. It's currently about $230 million GDP annually. We have about 4,000 people work in the state. But even more importantly, I think we have to recognize that what we'll call digital media, which is all the content we're all seeing on our phones, on our computers, in the airport, in the science museum. We have the leading science museum, IMAX filmmaker here in Minnesota. It's all being generated. I mean, this is a growing industry. And it's an industry that our Fortune 500 companies here combined spend about north of $100 million a year here in our state. And they will tell you, even though Ameriprise would never apply for Snowbank, they consider it important that we have an incentive because it helps the business it brings in addition to what goes on here all the time, keeps our crews sharp, keeps them trained, keeps our infrastructure strong, and it provides additional business for infrastructure development and investment. And so when you go to a rental house, they have the latest, greatest thing because the movie that just came in demanded it. And then they use all of that equipment. They use all the skills that our post-production houses provide. So the incentive even for Minnesota companies that would never actually be recipients of the reimbursements, they still consider it to be important. And we've had Minnesota companies here testifying to that before.
Ms. Winter, thank you very much for being here today, and thank you for your work.
Thank you.
Members, we do have a quorum, and we have two sets of minutes that are before you from the 22nd and 17th. Would someone move those minutes?
I'll move those, Mr. Chair.
Representative Lilly moves those minutes be approved. Any additions or corrections? If not, all in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. The minutes are approved. Next, we have Niall Zygmunt. Ms. Herr from Council on Asian Pacific. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Eileen Herr, and I'm the Executive Director for the State Council on Asian Pacific Minnesotans, and I am happy to be in front of you again, and I'm just going to just share my thoughts about our budget recommendation and looking at it, and also the real ramification to our agency. Our agency runs on a small budget, and a 15% decrease would mean significant to our small office, although the funding cut would be approximately $40,000. That is the loss of a staff person, and our outreach and really our ability to maintain a statewide mandate and a statewide effort and push. We realize that this is tough economic time, and we are willing to shoulder our part of the responsibility. And I was a little surprised that we were that we took actually the 15% reduction in that. And I've talked with the other directors, and we stand firm that we are all willing to, and the other directors, I mean the Council on Chicano Latino Affairs and Council on Black Minnesotans, in that we're all willing to share the burden, but that we ask that the burden be equally distributed. So I am wanting to just have some discussion with you to answer your questions if you have any about the real reality of our budget cuts and what that would mean to our small state agencies.
Well, thank you for being here, and these cuts are not reductions are not pleasant for anybody, and I would hope that all of the organizations, ethnic groups that we have, communities, I would hope that this situation would help spur additional discussion about the possibility of sharing services, sharing location. I would hope that this situation would help revisit that issue on the part of all the councils. We're not ordering that in this bill, but that still is an issue that needs to be addressed.
Mr. Chair, you are correct in that the councils and I, we've been trying to be as innovative as we can and been trying to work together as much as we can. And it is true that each of us have a statewide mandate, and our community lives in different areas and for the most part have similar issues, but at the same time have different issues and different needs. So we collaborate as much as we can on shared issues and then try to focus on our community needs as best we can to help our community be successful in contributing members of the society. And we will, and we take that under advisement very seriously. So thank you for your direction.
Thank you. Representative Stensrud.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the testifier, I know I've spoken with Representative Hayden, and both he and I would be interested in meeting with you and the other councils. I know he shares our interest in if there's any way we can collaborate and, or co-locate, or, you know, we keep talking about shared back offices, or, you know, if there's some opportunity, we'd love to sit down with you and, you know, if we can some way be part of helping make that happen or work with you. I would look forward to meeting up with you and Representative Hayden as well.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
Mr. Representative, thank you for your offer, and we will meet with you. And also I want to acknowledge that with the continued funding from the general fund, I do appreciate your commitment to making sure that all Minnesotans are at the table and are part of the policy-making decisions. So I thank you for that, and there are challenging times, and definitely people still need to be brought to the table, so I will definitely follow up with you on that. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Herr, and appreciate your being here today. Next, we'll call down Dr. Jolly. Welcome. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Dr. Eric Jolly, president of the Science Museum of Minnesota. I will be brief. The Science Museum and our staff have had a chance to review the budget recommendations of this committee, and we would like to say we can do it. Thank you. When we realized the crisis that the state was facing, the Science Museum senior staff met, and 9 months ago, we reorganized the Science Museum, and I reduced my most senior reports by 28%. We looked at ways to manage this in advance. We came and testified, and we know that it was a hard decision for us to change our staffing patterns and practices. And we ask that you allow us to take what we could of the state general funds and use it to leverage as best we can to serve the people of the state, providing support for schools, for homeschoolers, for families, and for this state's educational mission. We believe that with this cut, there will be pain. We will close, but we will not close on days that we have the highest levels of service. We will cut back, but we will not cut back on the greatest amount of leverage. We want to thank you for meeting us halfway. We will make this work and appreciate that there will be more compromises in the future and that you've made a very difficult set of decisions, and we are very glad that you are the body making the decisions and that I don't have to deal with this kind of a budget issue. I want to thank you for your time, your consideration, and for the degree that you were able to leave our mission intact and our capacity able.
Thank you very much, Dr. Jolly. Appreciate that very much. Thank you for being here. Next, Hector Garcia. Larry Redman. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Lawrence Redman. I'm here today representing Minnesota Citizens for the Arts, who I have represented before this legislature for 34 years. I mention that because there are some systemic comments that I want to make later. And as a student of the legislature, I think I just wanted to mention that long period of time that I've worked on these particular issues. Over the last few months, as we, the field, the community, the citizenry of the state, and so forth, who are concerned about the arts, have come before you to talk about the appropriations to the state agency, the State Arts Board, and the regional arts councils, we have asked for basically an issue of kind of parity in terms of budget cuts and so forth. We understand fully the dimension of the difficulties the state is facing in the shortfalls, and we, being Minnesotans, believe that we have to share in that. Indeed, throughout the entire state, arts organizations have had furloughs, they have had reductions in salaries, they have had substantial layoffs because of the recession. They realize that as part of the reality, and they certainly appreciate and understand the difficult job that all of you have before you. The reason that we're here, frankly, though, is because the fact that the cut to the State Arts Board and the Regional Arts Council system is distinguished in this bill by the fact that it is one of the larger cuts that is in this particular proposal, and indeed is the largest of the like areas that is the issues that have to do with the cultural welfare of the people of Minnesota. Now, we understand and think of this committee, and it's certainly its leadership, as being friends and allies of our cause. And I want to state that very clearly because there's a long history of that, and I realize these numbers could even be much worse than this. However, the number does stand out as being higher and in contradiction, we think, to some extent, to that parity question. We don't think that's a failing in the commitment of anybody at this table. We think it may have something more to do with some systemic circumstances of the legislative process. I mentioned many years have looked at this, worked on this over these issues, and I have to say that for some reason there's often a tendency with arts funding to look at it as something that can suddenly be the pool of money to find some dollars when all of a sudden at the very end of the process there are no dollars to be found. I've lost count of how many times in conference committees suddenly a problem showed up and a few million dollars had to be found to round off the conference committee and close it in those late hours of the session. And when that tension comes more than once, suddenly that has fallen specifically on this one small state agency, the State Arts Board. I'm not quite certain why that happens so regularly and uniquely to this particular agency, but the results of it are particularly difficult to the field. There are 1,400 to 1,500 arts organizations throughout this state that are very, very dependent and look forward to the largesse that the state provides to these numbers. I must mention that among some of the largest of those organizations, if one were to look at the state contribution to their operating budget and compare it to some of the other agencies funded even in this bill, you would find that they actually receive smaller percentages, significantly smaller percentages of their operating budget from the state than some of the other organizations who you've heard from and that you have funded here. Now, the reason they do that and don't go it alone is because those larger organizations believe that they have a stake in sticking with the mid-size and the small arts groups together. They believe certainly that there's political advantage to that, but more importantly, they believe that they want to build a comprehensive system that touches every county of the state, that touches every child, touches every senior citizen, that touches every citizen of whatever age, to provide for their ongoing education in regards to the arts. So they stay in that. But when this legislature responds by, in fact, looking at the Arts Board as a place to grab those last dollars, which is the only explanation I can see when I look over that span of 34 years, it creates a hardship and a problem that affects the citizenry of this state. Those organizations are a very, very key element to our life here. As I drove to the Capitol yesterday, and as I drove to the Capitol today, not a very friendly environment faced me or anybody else on the roads. It was a challenging day, one of those days where you wonder why you're a Minnesotan. But all of us in this room, I think, fully believe that there are benefits of living in this state that make that little obstacle of weather a minor problem. The arts are part of that. No matter where you go in this nation or where you go in this world, if people bring up the issue of Minnesota, I strongly think you will find that they will mention one of the arts organizations of our state as one of the banner things that makes Minnesota famous and important, and makes it a reason that we want to live here, that provides the quality of life, that causes us to get beyond the difficulties of the day that we're experiencing even today. This is not also just for our soul, for our certainly beyond our entertainment, and it's even beyond our educational needs of the public that all of these organizations serve. It also sells our products. I was first brought into this activity not necessarily by the arts organizations themselves, but by the leaders of large corporations who inhabit our state, who believed that protecting that kind of environment through this activity was important to selling their products in other portions of the United States and throughout the world. They also believed that it was absolutely important to being able to maintain employees here and bring more employees here. Yesterday, I had a conversation with one of our largest corporations in the state. They were thinking about they were going to have a meeting this very day with some folks about having another enterprise that may end up coming here, which, by the way, would add somewhere between 500 and 1,000 jobs possibly to our state's economy. This evening, as they're spending the day talking with these people, trying to show them why our particular state's going to benefit from this. This evening, on this very bad weather day, when we're trying to sell Minnesota so we'll have more Minnesotans, what are they doing? They're taking those people to the Guthrie Theater. Now, if you were to go to the Guthrie Theater today, bad as the weather is, you're going to see school buses in front of that from around our state that are educating that. So during the day, we're taking care of the kids in that particular function, and tonight, we're trying to bring employees to our state. I would not be before you today if this cut was more in a 10 or 15% range, to be perfectly frank, Mr. Chairman, because we understand the difficulty that you're in, and we would forbear making a comment. But looking at the number as it stands out, as it is at the 20% number, which we think is out of sync with these other categories, knowing the circumstances that we face, and knowing the budget cuts that the organizations have taken, I thought it was important to come and make these comments today in hope that in some future iteration, this bill, whether it's between now or perhaps even as early as Thursday, that there might be some kind of adjustment made. Otherwise, the signal that is being given here is somehow the arts, who play this role, don't quite stack up to those other categories where the decision was made to cut them at only a 10 to 15% rate. It's a snowy day, but we're optimistic that the sun's going to come out and spring will come, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. I'd like to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you, Mr. Redman. Representative Kahn.
Well, one of the things that we talked about last year when we were dealing with the first legacy funding was this question of supplementing versus supplanting. And one of the examples, and I believe that we did our budgets with that in mind at all times, was, clearly you could take the strictest interpretation and say you would never any budget that you ever cut when you gave legacy funds was supplanting. But the more charitable and the more sensible interpretation was made was that if the funds, things that were supported by legacy were cut no more than other similar things, than the other parts of the budget, then it was clearly in line. And I think all of the people, like Mr. Redman just said, agreed with that. I think the 20 is clearly out of line, and I really think that we're in for the charge of, and this is not, it's not something, this is a constitutional issue. This is not something that we just get to play around with in the statutes. And I think that when you got into a court of law, depending on what happened, you might have an interpretation that supplanting means any lowering of the budget. So I would be very careful about inviting it with this out of sync number.
Representative Kahn, I think the reality is that no matter what we do, there's that possibility.
But I think this asks for it.
Well, it may be the case.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Redman. Representative Lilly.
Mr. Chair, this morning when I was driving in, and that's probably why I jumped on you a little bit in my first comments, I was listening to the radio when they're talking about the person in Mankato or on the river down there that died. And I was thinking, but it kind of, you know, about that loss and then you being from Moorhead and the floods and those sort of things. But it kind of all started yesterday because I had an opportunity. I guess we can maybe blame that on the arts, because I had a chance to go to the Guthrie last night myself to see a play. And it's funny when we're, not funny maybe, but, you know, we're in this building and we're fighting for what we all believe in. And I had an opportunity to kind of stop and think as I kind of walked up there in that beautiful building. I've not been in there yet. And during intermission, went and looked over the river, and you have a chance and you look at the new bridge that went up, that went down because we didn't take care of our business as a state. And, you know, so they have that beautiful new bridge, but, you know, out of a bad thing came good things. And I think that's some of what you're doing, is trying to look at reforms and turn some good things. So I support some of that, of course. But it was, you know, it's with the public art, and you get a chance to reflect. And then you look out another window over there, and you got the Metrodome, and the roof's collapsed on that. And so we need to fix that situation. But, you know, I just really value the arts. And, you know, as far as being an opportunity of why you pick Minnesota, I think Mr. Redman really affirms that fact and the value. So here I am leave from North St. Paul in a blizzard, go to Minneapolis, which I really don't like to go to Minneapolis if I can help it. And, you know, they eat sushi and stuff there.
You know, so, they have that in North St. Paul too these days.
So we, you know, it's just a quality of life thing, and the value, and having the opportunity to serve on a legacy committee the first 2 years, and just appreciate the arts even more, just hearing their story, and sitting by Representative Erdahl, and I know he appreciates the arts community and what it brings to Minnesota. But I really think we need to look at that and reconsider if we can make it, you know, in line with some of the other cuts. So thank you.
Thank you. Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess there are kind of 3 points I'd like to make. One is really echoing what Representative Lilly said. I'm here to kind of represent people who've moved to the Twin Cities and Minnesota in general for the fantastic kind of culture and investment in education and healthy economy that we have here in Minnesota. You know, I've worked here for 12 years in Fortune 500 companies, and the arts is a big part of how Minnesota gets people to move here. And I will say that Minnesota is one of the hardest places to get people to move away from. And I think the arts is, of course, part of that, too. I also, as a second point, just want to draw our attention to, so that it sees the light of day, when we turn back to page 19 and 20 of the budget that was handed out today, so it's a little bit bigger print, I just want to make sure everybody sees that the way the money is allocated amongst the regional art councils, the grant programs, and operations is also, I think, in need of discussion. So I just want to bring our eyes to that, and maybe we'll have that longer discussion at a later time when testifiers aren't here. I'm sorry? Oh, sorry. And then the third point I'd like to make is actually some back-of-the-envelope math that Representative Winkler did here, which shows that if we adjust for inflation and we look at how the Arts Board was funded in 1996, and adjusting for inflation, we are still down 20% to how we funded the Arts Board, 12 years ago. No, my math is wrong. 8 years ago. Wait, no, it is 12. I'm sorry. So I just want to point out that we are down 20% from 12 years ago. So, you know, as we take into context all of these cuts, that seems pretty extreme.
Representative Green, Mr. Redman raised the issue with me yesterday in terms of the distribution, and we're open to that. He suggested a different breakdown on
of the split.
Yes, the split on that. So We're open to that. Mr. Redman, do you want to comment on that?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, thank you. We think that the administrative line of the budget was too hard cut in this. And I would like to stress in this regard that as the representative of the field, and the State Arts Board certainly can tell you this, that we are often aggressive over there about not wanting your administrative budget to get too big. We want the money in the field. We want the money going to arts organizations throughout the state. However, to do that responsibly and effectively, we think that that budget has to be at a different number. So there's proportional, we think an across-the-board cut in all three lines for operations and services, grants, and then the regionals would be a more appropriate way to do that, and I've been specifically commissioned by the arts community to pass that on to you and pass those particular recommendations. I might add the Senate last night, for what it's worth, did in fact have similar language to that same
thing. Mr. Redman and Representative Green, we have an amendment drafted that would make that adjustment, and obviously we've got a long ways to go here yet before we resolve all these budget issues.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Redman. Mr. O'Fallon from Humanities. Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm David O'Fallon. I'm president of the Minnesota Humanities Center, and I'm here to be very brief. You gave us a 10% cut, and you preserved our seed corn. And I've used that image before because what you have done is still give us the capacity to be the innovative and entrepreneurial organization that we are, that we have to be. So I want you to know that, of course, we'll feel the cut, and it'll have some effect on program and possibly on a staff or two. And yet we are absolutely committed to having results, to being entrepreneurial, and to focusing our resources on those programs, communities, and projects that really do have impact. And I've spoken to you about some of those before, and I don't think I need to go into any detail with you on those today. But I do want you to know that we appreciate the preservation of that critical seed corn capital. I've made the observation before, we have a responsibility and no authority. And yet 80,000 people across the state chose to work with us last couple of years. So in that spirit, we accept the recommendation and are prepared to go forward. I'm not sure this is the right word for the humanities, but in some ways what you're doing is you're funding the skunk works. We have to be innovative and entrepreneurial. We're not going to do very well, and I kind of love that, so we are.
Well, thank you, Mr. O'Fallon. And we know that you already have an established working relationship with the ethnic councils, I believe all of them, if I'm not mistaken. And I'm wondering if we're not going to do it here today and now, but if we might explore with you the possibility of how we might address the challenges that the ethnic councils have in their own sustainability and suffering reductions here while still trying to fulfill their mission, and the role that the Humanities Commission might be able to help in that regard. So I just wanted you to know that that I, for one, am open to those discussions.
Mr. Chairman, members, we're very open to it, and I think part of the pressure on all of us in this particular time is to look at new levels of collaboration and partnership and coordination. Frankly, focused on having real results and impact. So be delighted to have that conversation.
Well, I look forward to that opportunity. Thank you. Next, Jennifer Staubach. Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Jennifer Staubach. I am the legislative director for the Minnesota AFL-CIO, which is a labor federation made up of more than 1,000 affiliated unions representing more than 300,000 working men and women throughout the state. We just wanted to go on the record expressing our opposition to this bill. Just 3 years after a massive financial crisis, profits are rising rapidly, but companies are not investing. The non-farm, non-financial business sector was holding more than $1.9 trillion in cash in the third quarter of 2010, the highest level since the fourth quarter of 1959, while investment is at the lowest level in more than four decades. Yet the assault on the middle class and the contract rights of our public workers in this bill are said to be necessitated by our looming revenue crisis. Why are we not also talking about other expensive government obligations for which the beneficiary is business rather than labor? Public sector compensation is certainly not the cause of our current revenue crisis, but public employees have been doing their part to help us cope with the sudden revenue shortfalls. Public employees have taken significant cuts, from unpaid furlough days to job losses to significant cuts to their benefits in order to help balance the budget. Attempting to close our budget deficit by reducing employee compensation will be extremely damaging to our state's economy. The national economy is down 7.5 million jobs since the start of the Great Recession in December of 2007. Cutting additional jobs, not to mention the additional employment those jobs help support, would be a devastating blow to our fragile economic recovery. Minnesota's economic future depends on laying the foundation for a long-term economic growth by making sound investments in our schools, our infrastructure, and our workers. We need these investments for our economy to grow, and we need our highly skilled public sector workforce to put these policies into effect. This bill is just continuing with failed policies of the past and undermining workers' rights and their families' livelihoods. It is not the answer. Let's get back to focusing on the real issues and get Minnesotans back to work and balance our budget fairly. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Shaba. Christine Almeida. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members. Thank you. My name is Christine Almeida, and I'm here representing Minnesota Public Radio. Special thanks to Ms. O'Neill for putting me on and then taking me off and then putting me back on again due to a little trouble I had with the weather. Thank you for that. Very briefly, I just want to say on behalf of Minnesota Public Radio to Mr. Chairman and to the committee, thanks very much for including us in this piece of legislation. The reduction that we have in your bill is 15%. We've taken a look at that, like many of the others obviously have, and we can work within the number that you have given us. Specifically, these funds, the general funds that Minnesota Public Radio receives, go for two purposes. One is for replacement and repair of equipment, antenna, and other items of that nature for stations in greater Minnesota. And this year specifically, $154,000 of this amount that you've appropriated will go to do FCC upgrades to the emergency alert system and to the Amber alert system, which is the system that we have for tracking and announcing emergencies in terms of missing and abducted children. So thank you. That's all we really wanted to say.
Thank you very much for being here. Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure if this is a question to you or who, but I just was wondering about the difference between the grant reduction for public television. It appears to be a 10% reduction for the matching grants and no reduction for the equipment grants, and NPR has a 15% reduction. So I wonder what the difference, why NPR got a significantly larger total reduction compared to public television and, I guess, compared to AMPRS.
Trying to reconstruct the discussions there. We've had lots of detailed discussions about various pieces of this, and I think it had to do with the size of the operation and ability to accommodate reductions You know, that has to be a factor. Some entities would have a much harder time doing a 10-15 percent than others. There's no magic there, I guess. Just have to make that kind of judgment. Representative Kahn.
Well, Mr. Chairman, again, let me get into some of the back history of these appropriations. Again, at one point, there were ferocious fights for support between AMPIRS and NPR and public television. And there was the, to use the Representative Davis term, peace in the valley. And what happened, they were all made equivalent and equal, and they stayed that way through all the years. And again, this is the first diversion from that. And I get, again, going back to past history, it's a really big mistake. They both had what ended up when that arrangement was made was a significant increase in the appropriation for AMPIRS because of their existence throughout the state. The other thing that NPR is really important, I mean, we may think of it in terms of luxury, but NPR is the premier station through the state because of its location all through the state for the Amber Alert system. And, I think it's a really bad idea to give them this disproportionate cut. That's a service that none of the other, that the AMPIRS stations do not perform, that the public television doesn't perform. And so just, again, after we fix something once, it's really bad idea to unfix it.
Okay, next on the list is Gene Lee.
Hi.
Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you. I won't repeat what I said before as far as, I'm Jean Lee, President and Executive Director of Children's Hope International, on our family centers, and also I head the Asian Pacific American Housing Consortium. I previously testified as far as the different organizations. What I didn't mention before is that our organization has been a private nonprofit since 1974, and we have never received government funds. We have done pretty much this, a lot of things that organizations that have come before you have done and are receiving government aid. So, excuse me if I'm in trouble talking. Anyway, our target audience, as mentioned, was more than the 200,000 in the API community, where we're also targeting the 400,000 veterans in another initiative. The reason I thought I would speak to you at this time is it came to my attention, and I mentioned being a former corporate auditor, and we decided not to ask for funds, understanding your budget constraints, and that by doing things better and smarter, we could work within the existing systems to be able to even expand services. However, we also learned of some new information regarding one of our competitors, which is McVie, in that they testified before Representative Anderson's committee saying that they were the only ones who were servicing veterans. In this particular case, and they also testified as far as not having or doing the same thing that LSS was, Lutheran Social Services, was doing. It recently came to my attention that they were in fact asking for extra funds to do the same thing that LSS has been known to do, and in about 2 years ago, LSS went to four different committees asking for funds to do the same thing. They went through Health and Human Services Committee, Jobs and Economic Development Committee. They also went to the Veterans Committee asking for the same thing. And at that time, it was allowed and done. But then they also went into the pot where everybody else was competing through Minnesota Housing Finance Agency asking for money for the same thing. Our concern is that since you're going to be looking at funding MACV through what came through the Veterans Committee, and they didn't know what was going on in the Jobs Committee. And the other day they were hearing tons of people talk about how they were servicing the homeless and veterans and everyone else, that there are efficiencies and effectiveness in having some of the same topics and same issues brought together under one committee that hears it all and knows who all the players are, instead of the process where one, the left hand doesn't know what the right hand is doing, and they're kind of duplicating efforts and things for more than the same price or the price that's necessary. Now, our other concern that I wanted to raise is that we want to serve the veterans. The state has determined that, the Veterans Affairs has determined that, and I think what's necessary is a coordination, a way to coordinate the services and where everything else is coming from. So, for example, when MACV was saying, well, we're going to do legal services, well, what everybody in the industry does with legal services is they refer to legal aid or SMERLs, and especially when they're doing housing, and to give them extra money to do that versus why don't you just give the money to SMERLs to be able to do the legal advocacy that's necessary anyway, since they are the ones that have the attorneys. So this is an example as far as some of the inefficiencies that are going on, and you're paying double money for doing the same thing or just for somebody to give a referral that everybody else could do. And what they've done is just put it on the brochures, and at their different events just say, here, these are the places you can go to for legal services. Or if you're interested in employment, everyone's using the workforce centers. Well, the workforce centers have it already in the programs, for example, under deed and under the county budget, that they're providing the services, and for groups to get money just to give referrals, it seems like an overlap or duplication of effort and money. So I just wanted to point that out, thinking that if there was a way that we could coordinate everybody who's working on the issues together, and that they could better deliver services instead of and use the money more wisely, that you are the body who has representatives in all these different committees, and Representative Gunther and Anderson isn't here, that they could be talking to each other and saying, hey, we're doing that in this committee and these are the different groups, let's collaborate and really work to solve the problems, you know, cheaper, more efficiently and effectively. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Lee. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to be heard relative to this bill? If not, members, reminder that the amendments are due by noon today. There will be an author's amendment. We've already identified some things we need to fix. I'm sure that others of you will have more you want to fix, and so we anticipate that, and we will start the markup process tomorrow morning. I hope that we're able to finish it tomorrow morning and do not have to reconvene tomorrow night. I know several of us are also in the middle of marking up the Health and Human Services bill, and other committees have a similar kind of thing, so I sure hope we can finish up by noon tomorrow. Members, Ms. O'Neill has asked to remind, have you make sure you put your committee materials relative to the bill in your today folder so we don't have to reduplicate. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense to keep chopping down trees here to replace things we've already gotten once, so I'd appreciate it if you would do that. And with that, we're adjourned.